You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Maloney, and I'm the Interim Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this Brookings Robert Bosch Foundation Transatlantic Initiative event. We are delighted to be joining together with our longstanding partners at the Bosch Foundation in hosting what promises to be a timely and important event. Our discussion today focuses on the impact of COVID-19 on transatlantic relations and the prospects for renewed cooperation between the United States and Europe. The past few months have seen our world upended as the novel coronavirus spread from China around the world. In the course of addressing this unprecedented challenge, the pandemic has laid bare numerous flaws in our societies and differences in our approaches that have damaged the transatlantic relationship. The Trump administration has focused on America's domestic struggle against the coronavirus, leaving traditional U.S. allies to fend for themselves. Internationally, in the absence of U.S. leadership, our traditional allies in Europe have drawn together. For instance, through the European Commission's digital fundraising initiative that netted roughly $8 billion for coronavirus research. But authoritarian challengers like China have also sought to benefit from the global coronavirus shutdown, waging an aggressive propaganda campaign and strategically donating medical equipment for political gain. Our discussion today will center on a number of key questions relating not only to what COVID-19 has cost the transatlantic relationship. At stake is not just the future of our individual countries, but also the future of our alliances and the global order. I count myself incredibly fortunate to welcome such a distinguished group to discuss these issues. First, we will be joined by Irish Finance Minister Pascal Donohoe to discuss Europe's response to COVID-19. Then we will host two panel discussions focusing on the geopolitical impact of COVID-19 and what the pandemic means for transatlantic cooperation on global issues. Finally, we will close with a conversation with Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez-Laya, who will discuss the future of Europe post-COVID. In putting this event together, we are grateful for the support of the Robert Bosch Foundation. As I noted at the outset, this event is part of the Brookings Robert Bosch Transatlantic Initiative, or BBTI, which aims to expand our networks and work on how best to further transatlantic cooperation to address global challenges. Now, I'd like to turn things over to Henry Althocker, Senior Vice President at the Bosch Foundation, for a few opening comments.
Thank you very much, Susan, and good afternoon to all of you who are sitting on the European side of the Atlantic. I'm very thrilled it's a great pleasure to see you here and to have such a great turnout, although it's very sadly that we can't meet in Washington, D.C. like we normally would and meet in the offices of the Brookings institutions, which obviously for coffee breaks and informal chat and many other things would have been a much more suitable environment. But I am thrilled that we are trying this experiment of having a completely virtual event this time for the first time in BBTI, and hopefully we can use some of the advantages that offers, and the distinguished speakers that we have lined up are, I think, part of that, because I doubt that all of you would have been able to come to Washington right now, and so I'm very excited and thrilled that we're having this conversation amidst this current very difficult period of time. And COVID-19 has impacted nearly every country in the world. And I'm afraid that it has shown the best and the worst in us, both on the human level, but also on a political level. And COVID-19 is not just a medical issue, as we all have learned, or public health issue, but it's an issue of politics and of societal challenges. And it's a domestic and an international challenge for the transatlantic relations, but also for the European Union and for the general international rules-based order. And I'm afraid that currently, talking transatlantically, I assume that everybody on this call has the United States and Europe at their heart. Obviously, we are facing two pandemics. You're facing the pandemic of COVID right now, and then the second pandemic, which is institutional racism and police violence, which troubles all of our countries, and which are both coming together in this unfortunate time. But today, as Susan said, we're talking about COVID-19 and its impact on both Europe and the European Union. And I am particularly thrilled to hear what Minister Donohue is going to say, and whether he's thinking that the German-French initiative is going to reignite the engine of the European Union, or whether we are continuing into this slightly dissonant conversation that we had over the last couple of months. But COVID-19 also affects the transatlantic relations, and it will for a long time affect those, no matter who's going to win the elections in fall. And it does so in light of a changing international order. We have exciting speakers lined up, and since we are a little bit late, I'm going to end here and hand over to the much more exciting speakers who are going to give us fascinating input, and hand it to Tom Wright, who is going to introduce our first keynote speaker. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Henry, and thank you to Bosch for your continued support for this important initiative. And we are delighted to be able to meet virtually today. Obviously, it would be better to meet in person, but we hope to do so next year. So I have the great privilege and of opening the first session of four today, which is with Pascal Donohue, the Ireland's Minister for Finance, who is a frequent visitor to Brookings over the last few years. And we are extremely grateful to him for joining us this morning or this afternoon in Dublin at such a busy time. Pascal has been Ireland's Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure since 2016, and he's been a TD, a member of the Irish Parliament, since 2011. As I mentioned, he's visited the Brookings on several occasions to talk about the future of the Eurozone and Ireland's economy. He's been critical in building new alliances within the Eurozone for Ireland after the financial crisis and also during the Brexit negotiations very successfully. He also, and I find this remarkable, is the author of several excellent essays on political economy in the Irish Times and other publications. I think he's one of the very few Minister of Finance in the world who's engaging in the intellectual debate on the future of the global economy. And so we look forward to hearing his thoughts on that. The COVID-19 crisis hit Ireland just after an election in February of this year. The government, which Pascal is a part of, continued to serve in a caretaker capacity to deal with the crisis. And after several months of a very restrictive lockdown, Ireland has succeeded in flattening the curve and is now reopening. Yesterday, Pascal was part of the Fine Gael negotiating team that reached agreement with Fianna Fáil and the Green Party on a new coalition that could take office in a couple of weeks. So this is a very busy time for him, but we congratulate you on that. And finally, today is Bloom's Day, I understand, so it's particularly appropriate, I think, to have this conversation. So, Pascal, thank you so much for joining us, and perhaps you could start out with some opening remarks, and then we'll have a conversation and then take some questions from those watching online.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for the introduction. And I want to begin by acknowledging and thanking Brookings for the really vital work that they are doing at the moment, to thank Tom for the introduction, and to say that many of us here in Ireland are particularly proud to see the role that Tom is playing in leading the work of the Brookings Institution in contributing to the debate in America and beyond in relation to foreign and economic policy. And with all of the challenges that we are facing, it has never been so important to engage and interact. We're all adapting to new ways of doing so and becoming, in different ways, digital diplomats. Over the last couple of weeks, I have been on a so-called virtual visit to Washington. I've met with senior figures in the White House, the US administration on Capitol Hill and continue to engage with US business. The one downside of this is that I haven't been able to visit your great city again, and in particular, its wonderful bookshops. Something I'm particularly conscious of as today is, as Tom has said, Bloomsday, when we celebrate one of our greatest writers, James Joyce. But I hope to be back in Washington one way or the other soon, and I really hope that Cramer Books and Politics and Prose are open when I visit. We are indeed, as all of the other introductory speakers have noted, living through an extraordinary time. Often it feels that we are witnessing huge historical shifts compressed into weeks and months. Lenin's observation that there are decades when nothing happens and there are weeks when decades happen has rarely felt more apt. In the space of a few months, the coronavirus has swept around the globe, leaving a wake of human and economic suffering. The World Health Organization notes that there are almost 7.5 million cases of infection and the tragedy of over 400,000 lives lost. Last week, the OECD noted that this is the worst health and economic crisis since the Second World War. This has created extraordinary uncertainty. We may need to adapt our economies and our societies to live with this new virus for some time. However, crucially, this crisis is of such a scale that no nation can successfully address it alone. Around the world, governments and central banks have taken unprecedented steps in budgetary and monetary policy to protect public health, jobs and incomes. And these interventions are transforming the policy and economic landscape. The Irish government has already committed exceptional financial supports for workers, for businesses, amounting to 13.3 billion euro, or 7.5% of gross national income. We've been able to act decisively and with scale because we managed our public finances with care in recent years. However, action at EU level has also been ambitious, and it has also, Tom, been essential. Here in Ireland, confidence in the European project is a vital condition of economic recovery. And European leaders have acted to provide this confidence. The Eurogroup played a key role, reaching agreement first on a 540 billion euro package of three backstops, one for workers, one for businesses, and one for governments. This was in addition to the prior actions from the European Central Bank through its 1.35 trillion euro pandemic emergency purchase program and the triggering of flexibilities in the Stability and Growth Pact and in state aid rules by the European Commission. The contrast with the European response to the global financial crisis a decade ago is stark and it's positive. And as the virus recedes, our priority now is to return the Irish, the European economy to health and to deliver the right policies to support job creation and growth, as so many of our citizens have lost their jobs in circumstances they simply couldn't have imagined a few short months ago. But as the historian Adam Tooze put it succinctly recently, it is easier, it turns out, to stop an economy than it is to stimulate it. Certain industries will face huge challenges to the changes in business and consumer behaviour that has been wrought by the pandemic, while others that are resilient will survive and then thrive. But again, in this area, Europe is looking to act decisively. The European Commission has published an ambitious 1.85 trillion euro package embedded in the EU budget to respond to these challenges. It includes a 750 billion euro recovery fund, Next Generation EU, which seeks to target funding to regions, to sectors that have been most affected by the crisis. It seeks to accelerate the digital and the green transitions. This is both welcome and it's necessary. It's a tangible demonstration of EU solidarity like never before. On this and using this as a foundation, we must aim for a recovery that lifts all member states and their citizens together so that everyone benefits. A recovery to which all members of the European Union contribute to and benefit from. And this is why the EU Recovery Fund is so important. And it's why we'll work closely here in Ireland with our partners in Europe in a spirit of solidarity to build consensus for agreement. And we do this, as Brookings well knows, in a challenging geopolitical landscape, which has been made more complex by coronavirus. The pandemic struck at a time when the anchors of globalisation and mutual interdependence were already under sustained pressure. If the interdependence of financial systems created higher risks in the last crisis, then the interdependence of supply chains created risks in this one. The pandemic revealed vulnerabilities in the way supply chains are structured, for example, impacting on the production and delivery of medical equipment and devices for our health services. And I think it's inevitable we will see a revaluation of how parts of the global economy are structured as we emerge from this crisis. In particular, we should acknowledge that the existing model of globalization, for its many benefits, did create vulnerabilities at a time of strain for citizens and states. However, I believe that the answer lies not in rejecting the concept of globalization, but by building a different and better global system that mitigates the risks of economic and political interdependence. And what does this mean? It means that rather than seeking to unravel globalization in its entirety or pronounce its demise, we should work to ensure a more resilient global economy through the role of Europe, through a stronger transatlantic relationship between the EU and US, through how we can appropriately diversify supply chains, through work to reform the WTO, improve competitiveness and investment in the purpose-led industries of tomorrow. And amidst this change, Ireland will again have to identify new opportunities and then pursue them. As a country that is deeply embedded in global and European supply chains and integration, I recognise this kind of change, this kind of debate is a significant development for Ireland. But with an economy that is based on diversity, I'm confident that we'll rise to this opportunity. And we all need to do this with care so that we don't replace one vulnerability with another and risk fragmenting the global economy. The future of the transatlantic relationship is vital to this global journey. Together, we account for a third of global national income. Together, we can be an engine for growth and recovery. With our unique ties to the US, Ireland will do and play its part to support a strong transatlantic relationship and act as a bridge between Europe and America. We'll also continue to invest in multilateral processes that are so necessary for the global economy and international stability. We need more international cooperation and understanding, not less. If we're to tackle this crisis, as well as all of the other challenges we're so familiar with, from climate change to migration and many other global problems that demand global solutions. And I believe that during this crisis, the European Union, through its economic interventions, is showing its commitment to this form of action and cooperation. The SMEs are small size. Ireland has always been willing to play our part and make a global contribution. We will, for example, learn tomorrow if we are elected to a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council. And we'll continue to make the case for a values-based, mutually beneficial relationship flowing across the Atlantic. So on this day, it seems on Bloom's day, very appropriate to end with Joyce, just as I began with him. When in a portrait of the artist as a young man, he wrote that the past is consumed in the present and the present is living only because it brings forth the future. We need, when the challenges are so great and when fractures appear too deep, to rededicate our efforts to bringing forth that future, to making the case for cooperation, making the case for moderation, and making the case for inclusivity. If we think of the pandemic as a global and common experience, the case becomes clearer for global cooperation on a coordinated health response, on the search for a vaccine, and on the safe reopening of our societies and the rebuilding of our economies. And I believe that together we can build the common ground that's necessary to do so. Thank you, Tom.
Great. Thank you so much, Minister, for those remarks. It's very thoughtful, and I think lots of food for thought. So if you would like to, if you're watching and you would like to ask a question, please on Twitter, just use the hashtag BBTI and it will get to us. And we will address some of those in 15 minutes or so. But Minister, I'd like to start really with just your reflections on the last few months at the Eurozone and EU level. When this crisis started, there was a sense, because healthcare is a national competency and not an EU competency, that it was every nation for itself. We saw Italy, which is particularly badly hit by the virus early on, sort of upset that the EU was maybe not as engaged. The Serbian president outside the EU was criticizing sort of the national response. But then as you observed, there was quite a rapid shift and greater cooperation, some real difficult meetings, perhaps late night Zoom meetings on reforms, but then there were breakthroughs and the French and German initiative as well. I was wondering if you could just give us your sort of reflections and talk us through a bit how the crisis was sort of understood initially and how it evolved. I mean, what was sort of the process by which leaders began to realize that this is an existential problem for the Eurozone and it is a different type of crisis than in 2008-09 that would require a different type of response?
Thanks, Tom. I think your question has summarized very well the different phases that Europe went through in dealing with the threats and challenges of this terrible disease. And I think it's fair to say that in the very early stages of it, there was a degree in which nation states refocused in on the most fundamental duty that they have to their citizens, which is that of safety and that of protection. And I think it would be fair to say that in the very early phases of it, the kind of coordination and communication that is a hallmark of how Europe looks to work together was absent as the scale of crisis became so apparent so quickly. But I think shortly after that happened, it became apparent to all of us on two different levels that this was a challenge that looked to challenge the very foundation of the European project. And it did so firstly because on a political level, the rationale for the European project at this point in our collective history, and as we look into a future that's always open, was one of how countries come together to achieve more than they can on their own and come together to engage in common activity in which national borders don't play that prominent a role. And of course, we were dealing with a phenomenon that did not know or did not respect national borders. And there was a real sense amongst leaders within Europe that if a project that's based on trying to subsume national borders into a different form of cooperation couldn't respond back to a threat that itself doesn't know borders, then the greatest of challenges would be posed for us. And as we began to see undertones develop nationally in response to concerns regarding lack of cooperation within Europe, this refocused all our minds on what the European response to this was. And how that manifested itself, Tom, is in the frequency with which Eurogroup and ECOFIN met during the early phase of this crisis, when we met a number of times every week, where we kept in contact with each other bilaterally, and we realised that if in the aftermath of the acute phase of this crisis, if that deepened fragmentation within the Eurozone, then our very foundations were challenged. And that realisation drove the action that I'm making the case for with you today.
Thank you. So we have a question from one of our viewers, one of the audience, who's Nick Loker at AICGS. And he has, I think, a very appropriate question to follow on. Nick's question is, how appropriate is the comparison between the EU Recovery Fund and the compromise forced by Alexander Hamilton in 1790, whereby the US federal government assumed state's debt? Is talk of a Hamiltonian moment overblown? I think that's really gets to the heart of the issue in terms of where the Eurozone is headed. And obviously many difficult conversations lie in the future, but we're living in a moment now that is a historical moment. I mean, this will be looked back on for better or worse as a fairly unique moment in our history. So it's very hard, of course, to foretell the future, but where do you think this is headed, and is such talk an exaggeration, or is it sort of a possibility?
So three different thoughts back in that. Let me say in two areas in which I do think there's a parallel, and then in one area in which I don't. The first area in which I think there is a fair parallel is that moment of Hamilton was a great moment of political imagination in which you imagined what was possible and imagine what needed to be done. And I think in the number of weeks that led up to the different interventions that I've touched on, then the intervention by Chancellor Merkel and President Macron, and then the package that was put forward by the European Commission, that was a moment, and they were moments of imagination driven by necessity. The second area in which I think the comparison has some parallel is because it was also looking at new forms of integration and how by a new form of integration you can do something in which cooperation can achieve that which can't happen when you're working on your own. The third area, though, in which I think the parallel falters a little bit is that, of course, a big element of that moment of Hamilton was all about mutualisation. And really what this intervention is doing is looking to the future rather than to looking to mutualise the death of today or the death of yesterday. And instead is looking at how new funding can be made available in the future by new forms of borrowing. So while I think there are some areas in which it is an appropriate analogy, I think there's one fundamental area in which this moment is different to that moment in America.
Thank you. So staying on the theme of the US, I mean, much has been made of the Trump administration's fairly nationalistic approach to this crisis, and we've seen that play out. But in the economic sphere, it seems like it's been a little bit different. The Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank have acted, in a big way very early on, much quicker and on a larger scale. than in 2008-09. And I was wondering if you could just maybe share your thoughts on, you know, how you see the international economic cooperation between the world's major economies, maybe beyond the presidential or prime ministerial level, like what's actually happening under the hood and how sort of significant is that? And could there be more, or what's your sort of take on what's been done to date?
I think to date, the interventions that have happened at the level of Europe and the level of America have played a vital role in mitigating the very worst that could have developed. I think there is a commonality in the sequencing that took place, in that in each case it appears the central banks moved with speed and with scale. And then shortly afterwards, the budgetary pillar and the fiscal pillar to accompany the monetary pillar was put in place. And here in Europe, there was a very clear sequence that followed, that the ECB, when the economic challenge became so apparent, it put in place the pandemic purchase program. It had a vital stabilizing role in sovereign markets. And that created the space then in which the finance minister of Europe were then able to work. And I think there's some positive parallels between that and what happened in America, where I think at state level and congressional level, the level of fiscal stimulus complemented what was happening with the Federal Reserve. I think it would be fair to say that at G7 and G20 level, that level of coordination perhaps hasn't been as apparent as it was in the past. But then I think critically, the speed of action in key parts of our world economically, I think has been proportionate. And of course, the big challenge we're all going to face now is, again, in comparison to a decade ago, to make sure that we get the balance right between tapering and adjusting those kinds of intervention and supporting the encouragement of employment and income, and getting to that equilibrium across 2020 and 2021 is, I think, going to be the preeminent challenge that global economic policymakers will face.
Thank you. You mentioned in your remarks one aspect I found very interesting was resilience and the sort of the interdependence piece, which is getting quite a lot of attention over here as well, particularly relating to China. Now, in the US sometimes it's called decoupling. In Europe, I think it's called diversification. But the sort of substance is relatively similar, and it's sort of rethinking unconditional integration that sort of took place over the last quarter century. I was wondering if you could just unpack that a little bit, and particularly since, you know, for the US, obviously such a significant part of the pharmaceutical sector is based in Ireland, and, you know, the US and European economies are very closely linked. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about what you have in mind, and do you think this will be mainly European and American separately, or would it be possible to have sort of a trusted partnership, you know, arrangement where there's, you know, a renegotiation of some of these key things, or what could be done to basically to ensure that our societies are maybe not self-sufficient, but collectively resilient to external shocks?
Well, I would challenge any policymaker who would put forward the case that self-sufficiency on a national or even regional level is a realistic objective in the context of the complexity and sophistication of the products that we are talking about generating and delivering that are then needed for the kind of healthcare that I think will become so important in the decades to come. And both in a European level and I think in an American level, those who are striving for a goal of self-sufficiency, I would make the case back, as I noted a moment ago, that we need to be really careful that we don't replace one vulnerability with another. And instead, the way I think we should look at this matter, and the transatlantic relationship is surely a prism within which we can try and make this work, is look at how we can come up with new forms of cooperation in which those kind of needs can be met inside our respective societies and countries. And if I look at where we are, for example, with healthcare, and if I look at the advanced healthcare needs that we will need to meet due to dealing with this pandemic and other challenges I think we'll have in the future, it's so unlikely that any one part of the world would ever be self-sufficient. And it's so unlikely that one part of the world, that if they ever approach being able to meet their own needs, won't need to share some of those products and some of those expertise with neighbours or other parts of the world. And I think despite the challenges of recent years that we're all aware of, Europe, as we have begun to debate about strategic autonomy, that concept now has evolved a little bit into the idea of open strategic autonomy. And it's moved into that space because of a recognition that self-sufficiency on its own only gets you so far. I think it's a really challenging area, Tom, a very demanding area. But I think if we don't approach it in the way of trying to find new forms of cooperation, I fear it could create other dangers and challenges in the future. And we have to try and avoid that happening.
Thank you. So the EU is meant to have a summit with China in Leipzig later this year. It's recently been postponed, maybe by a month or two, till December, during the German Council presidency. Sometimes the resilience discussion is sort of wrapped up in relations with China. Relations with China have been a little bit fraught in the European Union over the last 3 months. Could you just say maybe a little bit about just any sort of personal reflections on that? I don't know if Ireland's had much sort of interaction, you know, with China over the last 3 months of the crisis. But particularly looking ahead to the agenda later this year, and sort of the German, you know, presidency and its hopes for the Leipzig summit, and maybe Europe's future relations with China post sort of COVID, just where do you think that's headed? And it, you know, it seems like there has been a bit of a shift over the last few months on both sides.
Well, firstly, I think we're very fortunate to have our friends and partners in Germany as presidents of the European Union at this point, because for many, many different reasons, I believe Germany is so well placed to lead the debate and to engage with China at this point in our in the global relations between China and the European Union. On the level here within Ireland, I have to say that during our efforts to deal with this disease, and particularly in the very early weeks of it, the engagement and relationship that we had with China, particularly through their ambassador here and our ambassador in China, was one that was positive in efforts that were underway in relation to the sourcing of PPE. But I'm also aware and, you know, appreciate the concerns that are there regarding how we can, you know, maintain global stability as we look at a country of such scale where there both, you know, pose, you know, challenges and consequences in some areas, but are also partners due to the scale and due to the influence they have in the world. In terms of the work that we've been having and debates we've been having within Eurogroup and ECOFIN, I think it's fair to say that over the last number of months, our efforts have been consumed with how we protect and develop ourselves economically in the context of the disease. And I've no doubt at all now that in the coming months, this issue of external relationships, challenges and friendships will come back a bit more on the agenda. But as I said, we're fortunate at this point to be having Germany as president of the European Union as we look into that debate.
Thank you. So just turning closer to home, just yesterday you agreed the programme for government with the Green Party and with Fianna Fáil. It's a coalition, obviously, with the Greens. The Greens are sort of on the rise in different parts of Europe, and climate, of course, is a big part of Ursula von der Leyen's agenda, certainly pre-COVID. I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about maybe how this government might differ from the previous one and how it fits into that sort of green and digital, you know, agenda on a European-wide level.
So it's been a pretty busy few weeks and months here in Dublin between dealing with COVID-19 and then our efforts to put a new government together. But I'm really pleased that yesterday our three party leaders were in a position to agree a programme for government that now the members of our three political parties will have to consider and I hope ratify. In terms of how it is different from what has gone before, I mean, it's different on so many different levels, Tom. The first one, it is that it is historic in that it will be the first government in our country in the history of Ireland in which the two political parties of the centre, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, will both serve in together. And this is a unique moment amidst many other unique moments in 2020. And then as that relationship is developed in government, it will be done so in the context of the Green Party joining. In terms of how the policy platform is different, it's different in that the climate concerns are so preeminent in the programme for government that was negotiated. In particular, a renewed commitment to emissions reduction here in Ireland and a renewed commitment to how we can put together the infrastructure in our country that's really important for the transition to a lower carbon economy. We have spent many, many long days and long nights negotiating this agreement. And if we are successful in gaining the support of our members for doing it, I think it'll be a government like no other. And it'll have lots of challenges within it, but also great, great opportunities. It will also be important that that will be the first majority government that has been formed in Ireland since the aftermath of the global financial crisis. And that on a domestic level will be an important development.
Thank you. So one final question, which is maybe going back to the dominating crisis of 2019 and 2018, which is Brexit. We have one question from an audience member who asks, how has Brexit complicated Ireland's response to COVID-19? Have bilateral channels between Dublin and London functioned effectively? And perhaps since this is the last sort of question, you could also, you know, add on to that. It looks, you know, the UK is not going to ask for an extension. It looks like we maybe are headed toward a harder type of Brexit. Obviously, Brexit has been sort of overshadowed in a way by this greater crisis that's occurred, but it's still there. And I was just wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit. Obviously, this is a crucial issue for Ireland. You know, how are you thinking about it at the moment and what additional challenges does that pose on the economic front?
So it poses many, many additional challenges, and so much of my political life over the last number of years has now been consumed by dealing with Brexit at both an economic and political level. And while the negotiation has always been handled by the Commission of the European Union through Mr. Michel Barnier, it would also be fair to say that bilateral contacts between the Irish government and the British government have been vital at different points in the negotiation process. And I have had very close working and indeed personal relations at time with the previous chancellors of the Exchequer in the United Kingdom. And I am going to do the same with the current and new one. In terms of the challenges it will pose, a very hard Brexit on top of all that we are dealing with and all the harm that we are dealing with that has been caused by this pandemic on the Irish economy and the British economy would make a recovery even harder. There's no doubt about that. But we'd still get that recovery and we'd still get there, but it would just be a harder one. But if that's the case for Ireland and it's the case for Europe, I believe it would also be the case for the United Kingdom. I think it is a positive signal that when Prime Minister Johnson and Charles Michel, who's the President of the European Council, met only yesterday, both of them agreed to the need to reinvigorate the negotiations that are going to take place now in the coming weeks. And I think that's a really positive sign. And it's an expected positive sign from me, but it's really good that it happened. So I will end on a note of optimism on that particular question. I know to the left of your shoulder there, you've that fantastic book by Tim Shipman called Fallout that talks about the many ups and downs in British politics in recent years. And we have had lots of ups and downs in dealing with Brexit. But where there is a will, there's a way. And there is a great goal to be achieved by an orderly resolution of all of the issues in relation to Brexit, which is the value of a relationship that a country that has left the European Union, the United Kingdom, but one with which we still have so much in common from a values point of view. And I think for the rest of 2020, we have to strive to see, can we find a relationship which won't be as good economically as the one we have today, but maybe could be better than many are fearing we might end up with next year. And this is something that if we are successful in having a new government formed here in Dublin in the next few weeks, that through our membership of the European Union, we'll try and play our part in forming.
Mr. Pascal, thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. We look forward to welcoming you back and allowing you the opportunity to visit the bookshops around Washington in next year. We wish you the best of luck, both in the government negotiations and ratification and also in the UN Security Council vote tomorrow on the members that Ireland's up for election in. And we hope you have the opportunity to celebrate Bloomsday later on in a socially distant way. But thank you once again for joining us.
Well, Tom, look, thank you very much for the invitation. Just want to acknowledge all of the great work that goes on in Brookings for helping us understand where we are now and where we want to go in the future. And congratulate you on all the work that you're doing. If I talked about Tim Shipman to the left of his shoulder, I have to note for anybody viewing that to the right of your shoulder, All Measures Short of War, Tom's last book, is a fantastic understanding of where we are at the moment and some of the challenges that we have coming up. So hope all of the participants in the conference today have a productive and positive discussion. And I hope one way or the other, I have the chance to see you all physically soon. So thank you very much. Stay safe and good luck with everything in the future to all of you.
Okay, thank you everyone for bearing with us. We are ready to get started for our second session of the day and our first full panel, which is on the geopolitical impact of COVID-19 on transatlantic relations. And we are delighted to be joined by a really stellar panel and to discuss this. So we have with us Ivan Krastev, who is the chairman of the chairman of the Center for Liberal Strategies in Sofia, and has written many excellent articles about geopolitics and transatlantic relations, and also about the geopolitical impact of COVID-19. My colleague Amanda Snow, who is a Robert Bosch senior fellow, has worked on Brexit and Turkey issues as well as transatlantic issues more generally. Fiona Hill, who is our senior fellow and recently returned from a stint in the Trump administration as a senior director for Europe and Russia. Giovanna Di Maio, who's our visiting fellow in Italy, and also Kemal Qureshi, who's our non-resident senior fellow on Turkey. So without further ado, I think we'll jump right into it. And Ivan, maybe if we could start with you, but this is really the first crisis, people have said, that has a fracture in the transatlantic bond, that there isn't that traditional type of American leadership. We just heard from Minister Donoghue there that the European Union has actually responded effectively to it after a rocky start in the first few weeks, but there was some concern that it could also lead to the fracturing of the Eurozone, of the Eurozone project. So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us, how significant do you think this crisis is geopolitically, and where do you think we're headed?
That's it. So thank you very much for the pleasure of being on the panel. But there's several problems with this crisis. The one is that it has not ended. And from this point of view, it's very difficult because we can see a very different dynamics of what is going on. And secondly, our political imagination is done in the way that we are very good at remembering wars and revolutions, but we don't know what to do with pandemics. The statistics that I like very much is that, of course, the Spanish flu has killed much more people than the World War I, but we have 80,000 books devoted to the World War I and only 400 books to the Spanish flu. So from this point of view, obviously we're going through a kind of a very important moment, but it is not particularly clear what is going to be the impact. What I'm going to do is just give you the results of a survey that European Council on Foreign Relations did in 9 EU member states. It was done just now, two weeks ago, when the country starts to open. The results are not published yet, but they're very relevant to our conversation. Paradoxically, the biggest impact on the imagination of Europeans out of this crisis was that Europeans understood how lonely we are in the world. And this is a big way. On one level, the view of the United States really deteriorated all over these 9 countries, and we're talking about all major big countries plus strong South and East European representation. And this is particularly dramatic in Germany. And to be absolutely honest, part of it, of course, is President Trump and the fact that America didn't took its role as a global leader. But secondly, this was also images of the United States. United States starts to look as a broken country. You have this very rich country, which is spending so much money on public health, and then you have all this happening. And I do believe this is an important element, because in this first stage of the crisis, public opinion didn't play any important role. But now when the governments are going to reposition, and particularly knowing how vulnerable it is, this is going to be an issue. At the same time, basically, the view of China also changed. Not as dramatically, slightly different from country to country, but suddenly Europeans also saw a much more aggressive and ugly face of China, which was pressing Europeans to praise them, which basically are playing this type of a facial mask diplomacy. So the result of this is that suddenly Europeans, majority of them in all countries, started to go for something that I'm going to call progressive protectionism. By the way, there was nobody was highly impressed by the performance of European institutions in the public health stage of the crisis. But suddenly Europeans decided that we should stay together, not, to be honest, because of values or things like this, but because there is nowhere to go. And as a result of it, this is interesting to see that the relations with the United States are going to be very much kind of shaped by this. It's not going to be easy to believe that the relations are going to return back to normal, nevertheless of what kind of a changes are going to happen in the United States. Because suddenly for Europe, the fear of globalization comes back. The idea that we cannot rely on the United States, not simply because the United States is not interested in Europe, but probably because the United States is going to look much more inward. And certainly, you have Europe that started very much to look around itself and thinking basically only what is happening there. There is only one topic on which I do believe that particularly political change on the elections is going to have a major issue, and this is going to be the climate change issue, which continue to be quite important, particularly for the younger part of the population. But strangely enough, on one level, Europeans are becoming more and more mistrustful toward China. On the other, the real nightmare of the European leaders is that Europe is going to be squeezed to make a choice between United States and China in a much more aggressive way. From this point of view, and I'm going to end up on this, the most kind of emailed article, what I saw between the high-level European advisors and leaders these days, was the article of the Prime Minister of Singapore, why Singapore is unhappy basically to choose between the United States and China.
Thank you. And that's definitely a theme we want to come back to, I think, later on. But I'd like to turn to Giovanna next, if I may. Giovanna, Italy was particularly badly hit early on in this crisis. And I remember we had discussions about whether or not this would permanently damage the reputation of the EU in Italy. Obviously, things have moved on since then. There's been a bit of a more coordinated European response, but I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about the future relationship between Italy and the Eurozone and the EU and other EU member states, and if this crisis is likely to have a lasting impact on that.
Thank you to Tom, and delighted to be on this panel with such incredible colleagues and fellows. Yes, Italy has been particularly hit by the virus that has taken more than 34,000 lives, and also economically speaking, the forecast for Italy's GDP growth in 2020 is estimated of minus 9.1%. So, of course, this is going to reflect in Italy's foreign policy, but during this particular crisis, Italy has found itself directly affected by US and China confrontation. And in fact, since Italy, with the signing of a memorandum of understanding on the Belt and Road Initiative last year, has a particular place in Chinese European projection, and has been, it is no coincidence that Italy has been the main target for Chinese mask diplomacy and propaganda. And in fact, China really benefited from the initial hesitation of European Union member states in terms of exports of medical supplies and material. And in fact, due to also agreements between China Media Group and some Italian media, Chinese action has been particularly amplified both through diplomatic Chinese diplomatic channels, but also through Italian media. And this has definitely impacted public opinion because now Italians see China as the most friendly country, followed by Russia and then the United States. And France and Germany, in this poll released in March, they were considered as rivals and, of course, not friendly at all. But at the same time, the US responded to these Chinese actions through a more through showing support to Italy, and in fact decided to sign this presidential memorandum of assistance, basically granting Italy $100 billion in medical supplies. So for sure, Italy's foreign policy, even during the crisis, did not have a shift towards China, because this on and of course did not take Italy away from this from its traditional Atlanticism, but it seems like in this competition, Italy has been playing the game he has been doing for the Europe during the Cold War, basically trying to engage on multiple fronts, trying to maximize advantage. But of course, the debate on China, besides the public opinion, is particularly heated in Italy, with Five Star Movement being very much pro-China, the League and the center-right being very hawkish on it, and also very skeptical of the European Union, and the Democratic Party actually trying to find a common strategy. And in all of this, the fact that the US has, and this administration has not promoted a friendly approach towards the European Union also triggers the fact that Italy doesn't really see advantages in engaging with the European Union towards a more strategic view on China, and is keeping on doing this multilateral, multidimensional approach that actually is impacting public opinion, but also is thinking of short-term gains rather than long-term strategy. And I'll stop here.
Thank you, Giovanna. It's fascinating. Amanda, if we could turn to you next. I mean, the UK has surpassed Italy, I think, as maybe the worst hit country in Europe. Initially, the Prime Minister sort of adopted, you know, maybe a more sort of tough it out strategy, and then of course fell ill himself, and now while he has recovered, thankfully, you know, Britain is maybe slower in reopening than other countries are, and it's still very challenging. I was wondering maybe if you could give us your sort of thoughts and reflections on the impact on the UK, not so much on maybe the medical sort of an economic side, but psychologically. You know, Germany and others have fared a lot better. The UK, of course, has left the European Union partly because it thought it could do better on its own. What do you think sort of the real impact of this crisis is on the United Kingdom and on its sort of geopolitical future?
Thanks, Tom. Certainly the UK and Prime Minister Boris Johnson did not have a good crisis. The UK, as you said, was an outlier compared to the rest of the European Union countries in terms of their initial crackdown or closure in response to the crisis. They were much more focused on this idea of herd immunity, and they were also concerned about quarantine fatigue. One of the leading scientists has actually come out this week and said if the government had locked down a week earlier, they would have halved the number of deaths. The UK has been second globally to the United States in terms of the number of deaths, only surpassed this week by Brazil, which now pushes the UK into third. They are also really struggling economically. Numbers have come out for April that showed a 20% drop in GDP, and the OECD has said in recent days that they think the UK is going to be the hardest hit of all of the major economies by the coronavirus. As you said, Prime Minister Boris Johnson got sick himself, came very close to dying by all reports. And there really initially was a rally around the leader effect. And there had been some support for the government's initial actions, even though there had been a fair amount of criticism. That certainly has changed within the last couple of days and weeks. There was a botched rollout by the government of some of the provisions to try and reopen the country. It turned out that none of the devolved governments in Scotland, Northern Ireland, or Wales wanted to follow Boris Johnson in reopening as quickly as he did. The messaging was very unclear. And then there was a significant domestic scandal where one of his chief political advisors, Dominic Cummings, broke the very rules that he himself was believed to author by driving across the country while sick to shelter elsewhere. So in the wake of that, Boris Johnson's own popularity and the popularity of the government dropped 20%, which is a significant change from where Boris Johnson was in December when he won overwhelmingly in the elections with a 70 MP majority within Parliament. At the same time, the Labour opposition party has a new leader whose support has gone up nearly 30 points in recent days. So a very difficult domestic political situation for Boris Johnson at a time when the country has been hit very badly economically, has been hit very hard in terms of the number of deaths, and it's also exposed a lot of the weaknesses within the country, including some failures within the health system, and as we are seeing in the U.S., a disproportionate number of people of color that have been getting sick as opposed to others. And there have been similar types of protests to the Black Lives Matter movement that we've seen in the United States dealing with Britain's history of slavery and with colonialism. So what we are seeing the government starting to do in response to this is to try and shift attention away somewhat and focus on some domestic issues. So as Minister Donohoe was saying earlier, Brexit was back in the headlines this week. Boris Johnson met yesterday with the EU leaders. There was a lot of talk about wanting to expedite these negotiations on nailing down a trade deal. Boris Johnson has made clear he does not want to extend the transition period, which is set to end at the end of this year. Boris Johnson sounding very optimistic about getting this done by July, which I think most observers think is extremely unlikely, and also a lot of doubt about whether something could be done by the end of the year. So there is a possibility that if the UK ends up leaving the EU without a deal, you're going to have a second significant economic shock on terms of on top of the economic downturn that we've seen with COVID. At the same time, the UK and the US this week held their second round of trade negotiations. The UK government seems to believe that this will help put pressure on the EU as that moves forward. But those negotiations are going to be difficult. And then just this morning, news came out that Boris Johnson announced that he is going to merge DFID, the International Development Agency, within the Foreign Office, which is something that has long been a preference of the Conservative Party and a back and forth between Conservative and Labour. So I think what we are starting to see within the UK is a move back toward domestic policy, with Boris Johnson trying to regain control of the political agenda, given the very disastrous experience that they've had with COVID, including calls now for a national inquiry into how the government actually handled the pandemic.
Thank you. Fascinating. So Kamal, I thought maybe we could turn to you next and zoom out the lens a little bit, and then we'll come back in maybe to Europe. But this is a global crisis, of course. And one of the major challenges that the European Union has had over the last 5 years has been on refugees and refugee flows and the conflicts in the greater Middle East. Saturday is World Refugee Day. You're doing a lot of work on this, and refugee populations certainly seem to be among the most vulnerable in the world to COVID for pretty obvious reasons. Could you talk to us a little bit maybe about this challenge, about what's being done, or the impact has the world and has the Europe and the US sort of changed its approach to dealing with refugees? And what do you think the scale of this challenge will be in the future, and how that's sort of affected by this current crisis?
As you've pointed out, this Saturday will be World Refugee Day, and it's also the day when UNHCR puts out its annual report on the state of affairs as far as displaced people go. I suspect that the focus is going to be on the way in which the pandemic has impacted on refugees. So far, I think the best report has come out from the International Rescue Committee, which has flagged out the way in which refugee and displaced people are experiencing a double emergency, in the sense that you hinted at, that their living conditions, the fact that they are living in very crowded premises. They cite, for example, very interestingly, how on the Diana Princess ship, that the rate of transmission was four times higher than in Wuhan. And the report focuses on a number of refugee situations where the population intensity is 8.5 times more than on the Diamond Princess. Now, interestingly, so far, the reporting we have managed to find is that there are very little transmission cases. But I suspect that this doesn't represent the real picture out there. The report also points out that the other side of the medallion is the way in which these refugees, 80-85% of them, find themselves in countries that are already fragile in infrastructurally, in the economic, political sense of the word. And their access to livelihood has been damaged with the way in which economies have been impacted. The fact that the World Bank and IMF and many others are predicting that trade is going to be impacted is going to affect these countries, many of whom are dependent on trade. My personal opinion is that there's been very little attention beyond the UN agencies and the countries that are hosting refugees themselves. Yet in December 2018, the international community, with the exception of the United States and a member of the European Union, Hungary, did sign under the Global Compact on Refugees. And the Global Compact does put forward a series of recommendations, policy recommendations, underlining the importance of responsibility sharing, but also adopting measures that will enable to improve the self-reliance of refugees, given that they find themselves in protracted situations, and that the classic durable solutions, that is resettlement and return, voluntary return and local integration, are not available. The best is to try to improve that self-reliance and make sure that refugees are not a burden, but also benefits the development of those countries. Another aspect of it is the emphasis put on resilience of host communities. Now, in that regard, some progress had been taking place prior to the pandemic. We saw the EU-Jordanian compact, where the EU has extended some trade benefits to Jordan in return for Jordan extending work permits and formal prospects of formal employment for refugees. There's some problems there, but that constitutes an important reference point. Similar compacts are being discussed and negotiated for Ethiopia, for example, that has opened up its labor market, but also Bangladesh that holds a large number of Rohingya refugees. There's also the case of the EU-Turkey deal sort of or compact from March 2016. I hear through the grapevine that there are negotiations to try to extend its duration, particularly in respect to funding, but that probably will need to go beyond that. However, looking forward, I suspect that the United States used to be the country that used to receive a lot of refugees through resettlement programs. And those numbers have fallen, as many of you may be aware, dramatically since the arrival of the Trump administration. That policy used to be an important burden sharing exercise, especially for host countries. Now, the situation in Syria, for example, has been deteriorating, and I fear that in the coming months and towards the end of the year, we're going to see growing pressure on refugees and displaced people, circumstances deteriorating, and prospects of further movement. The European Commission and the European Union, I understand, is trying to negotiate, but is encountering internal difficulties coming from some member states to try to put together a pact of solidarity with countries that host a large number of refugees. We're going to see how that's going to unfold in the coming months. And I'll stop here and look forward to questions if there are any.
Thank you, Kamal. And I should note before we go to Fiona that if you're watching and you would like to ask a question, just use the hashtag BBTI, that's BBTI for Brookings Bosch Transatlantic Initiative on Twitter, and we will see the question and we will ask our panel. Fiona, there's so much to discuss here, but I think, you know, what I think will be really interesting is to get your reflections maybe on the overall impact of this crisis. You worked on the Europe portfolio in the White House for several years. We've seen maybe a lack of international cooperation in response to this crisis, although, as Minister Donoghue said earlier, you know, economic cooperation has still been fairly vibrant. But then also on the impact on Russia. You know, Russia is a country that we don't know that much about in terms of the casualty numbers or the impact, but it does seem pretty hard hit. It has sort of punctured the veil of authority that Putin has, that he's a strong sort of leader in response to a crisis. This is a very bad crisis for strong men around the world. Erdogan, Bolsonaro, Trump, Putin haven't dealt particularly well, Xi Jinping haven't dealt particularly well with it. So maybe also what is the impact on Russia and its geopolitical future?
Thanks very much, Tom. I'll try to weave all of that together. And, you know, obviously Kamal can comment on Erdogan and Turkey at some point in the discussion. And I'm sure Ivana Mander and Giovanna have quite a lot to say on these topics as well. On the overall picture, you know, I think that we've already had quite a lot of this laid out very well about the reasons for lack of international cooperation. I mean, I think as Ivan was starting to sketch out there by, you know, references to historical events and also some of the polling, that we seem to have kind of come to the end of the long cycle that we've seen since World War II of global institutional creation and activity. It's kind of run out of steam. And, you know, even the European project is under some question now as well, you know, particularly given some of the points that Ivan made there and showing up in polling of European member states actually seeing some of their own counterparts as sort of threats here, and certainly no longer having the faith in the United States as one of the key players in the system that they had certainly after World War II. I think Giovanna's points about Italy seeing China and Russia as key counterparts and key allies, and the US in third place, even though Italy has always traditionally had a great deal of affinity to the US, even if as it's navigated among these other poles, is also very telling. So in part, it's the drop of the role of the United States. We've been leading from behind for quite a long time. Actually, it's not just most recently. We've seen trends over a long period of time here in the United States of kind of reluctance to always be at the forefront, particularly of military action, especially after our feelings of overextension, thanks to Iraq and Afghanistan. But also, I think part of our problem is, and I think we've all been bringing this out as well, as lack of a perceived shared threat, not just of shared opportunity, but of a shared threat. And, you know, Van pointing out the fact that we've had so little in comparison written about the Spanish flu, we've all been in these larger global trends or analyses pointing out to the impact of pandemics and climate change as potentially unifying factors. Well, actually, now we've found out that they're not. Because even in approaching something as a pandemic that ought to be a great equalizer, especially as a disease doesn't discriminate and can take anyone at any time, I know we've got differences in the way that different social groups have been afflicted by this, but that's because of our own societal deficiencies, not because of the disease per se, overcrowding or, you know, inadequacies in public health and people with underlying conditions that have, you know, been the result of poverty or inequality that are emerging. We have not actually found that we want to have a unified approach to the pandemic, and very similar on climate change. Everything has become politicized. So I think what we're all bringing out here is the problem of domestic politics. And Amanda touched on that in the UK context, Giovanna did in the context of Italy. And Ivan has touched on this in his overview. And obviously, Kemal can talk about this in the case of Turkey. So this is quite an astounding position that we find ourselves in here, where we're so, as a large collective on the transatlantic scale, consumed with our own domestic politics that we've been incapable, you know, as we were the exact opposite we were at the end of World War II, of mounting any kind of coordinated collective defense against the pandemic, and likely to be the case on the case of climate change as well. This gives me a segue into what I wanted to say about Russia, because very similarly to the UK and Italy and to the United States, Putin is turning back to domestic politics. As you said, Tom, Russia's actually been quite hard hit by the pandemic. We don't know the full scope, but in fact, Russia has made it clear that they have a very high level of infections. It's quite high in a European context. The death rate seems to be lower, and there could be all kinds of reasons for this, but the death rate among healthcare providers, nurses and doctors has been extremely high. In fact, the highest recorded just in terms of the per capita deaths. Obviously, Moscow, as a densely populated city, has been hard hit, but there's also been the kind of spread outside of Moscow to other cities and regions that we've seen in other cases. You know, part of the slowness in terms of that spread is just the sheer size of Russia. It remains the world's largest country by landmass. And just as we've seen in the United States, it's taken time for the virus transmission to move out of the major population centers into the rest of the country. Russia's been hit for the same reasons of poor organization, poor preparedness, lack of PPE, and the same issues that everyone else has had of the outsourcing of the production of key products, key medical supplies. So, you know, we've had all of the same problems. And as a result of that, The Russian government has been extraordinarily concerned to make efforts to deflect attention away from the weaknesses. You know, again, as we've all said, that what this pandemic has done is exposed all of the weaknesses in all of our societies and in all of our institutional arrangements. Amanda made that point in the case of the UK. It's the same with Russia, same with Italy, same with the United States, same with any country, I think, that we can point out in the group that we're talking about. And Putin had had a very ambitious domestic political agenda in mind. In January, he announced the amendments to the constitution and to the political system, providing the possibility for him to stay on as president, providing that he's put up for election again and re-elected out to 2036, two more presidential terms. And he has put off for some time, but now wants to put this back on the agenda again this month. At the beginning of July and this month, the commemorations for the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, the big Russian celebration that was supposed to cement his leadership as the father of the nation and the leader moving on to becoming, you know, much more entrenched as head of state, with a national referendum that's now been set for a few weeks, in which they need to have as much of a turnout as possible to vote for these constitutional amendments that would allow him to extend his presidential terms. So all of these have been announced again. Have also been announced phased reopenings, just at a time when you know, it's clear that the coronavirus is still not completely under check. So, I mean, I'll stop there, but I think, you know, what we're seeing is everyone focusing on the domestic politics and real challenges for dealing with this in any coordinated fashion. You know, sadly, every country seems to be dealing with this in its own ad hoc and somewhat haphazard fashion.
Thank you, Fiona. The domestic politics, I think, is a great segue to ask Ivan a question about the US election. You know, if Biden is elected in November, I guess the big question is how much of this goes back to the way it was, or how much of it goes back to something resembling sort of a normal transatlantic relationship, or does this crisis really have a different sort of logic to it? It sort of reminds Europeans, as you said, that they are sort of on their own, that the US will be inwardly focused. You know, an America First candidate could come back in 2024. How much of this do you think is permanent, and how much is reversible depending on election results here?
I do believe that after the elections of President Trump, for 1 or 2 years, European foreign policy elites were trying to believe that what we are seeing is just an aberration of the American foreign policy. So this is enough for Trump to be out and the relations will go back where they were. And I do believe this started to change. And this started to change because one thing that COVID-19 made very clear is certain cycle that started basically with 1945, went through the Cold War and so on in the American-European relations is over. We're in a new period. From this point of view, it's very interesting because President Biden, if he's going to be elected president, is very much somebody shaped by the Cold War. So Europeans personally feel quite comfortable, I mean, with President Biden. But one of the things that Europeans expected from the United States, and this is what we have learned during this long period, was that American presidents change, but American foreign policy does not change much, particularly when it comes to Europe. And this assumption is not there anymore. And also, I do believe that there are going to be two interesting developments to watch. Of course, in general, there was a quite strong criticism against President Trump in Europe, but there are several European governments who basically betted on President Trump. And for some of them, basically, the elections of Biden does not need to be very good news. And the idea of kind of a very unified European position is going to be interesting to see how this is going to react. For example, Mr. Orban basically made it very much clear. He sided within the domestic politics of the United States, which normally Europeans try not to do. So how this is going to affect a policy in which Europe is not going to be very much unified, and it's not only kind of Viktor Orban, he is simply the most well-known case. The other thing that I do believe is also going to change is that what I do believe Europeans fear is that the United States will go to Europe and say, okay, let's go together with a common front on China. And nevertheless, that in Europe, there is a major mistrust towards certain things that China is doing. I don't believe that Europe is ready for this. So from this point of view, paradoxically, you're going to see people who said, probably President Biden can be also a problem for Europe, because then you cannot excuse yourself with what President Trump is doing. And having a common policy on China is not going to be easy for economic reasons, for political reasons, but also, interestingly enough, because not so many Europeans try to frame the world in which we are living anymore, basically in a classical Cold War terms. And secondly, what is in my view critically important, what this crisis made Europeans particularly nervous about is the irrelevance of Europe, the fear that in a certain way Europe can get out of the picture, that we are basically going to be squeezed, we're not going to have enough choices to make, and that this can very much lead to the domestic problem, both in the member states, but also in the European Union itself. So from this point of view, yes, there are going to be hopes, and particularly on climate change. Of course, Europeans are going to expect very much from a Biden administration, because Europeans understand perfectly well that nevertheless of what Europe is doing on the climate change, in the absence of the America, nothing is going to change. But from this point of view, even this is also true for countries like China and India. And on the security front, this is also interesting, because as I told you, the country that is very interesting to observe when it comes now to transatlantic relations on the level of public opinion is Germany. Germany was the most pro-atlantic country. Germany was the one that basically was betting on the transatlantic relations as a coalition of values, as an economic project, as a kind of a pillar of globalization. And now you can see the German public opinion shifting away. Probably this can change. The good story about public opinion is that public opinion tries to change. It's not so much an opinion, but a mood. But at the moment, I do believe people are going to make a mistake if they believe that simply because Biden is back, Europe is back in its relations with the United States. Because also it's not very much clear where back. Europeans used to like President Obama, but Europeans don't like very much the European policy of President Obama.
Thank you. You mentioned about China, which I think will be something we should pick up with our other colleagues as well. Giovanna, you've recently written a paper on Italy and China, sort of tracking the relationship, an excellent paper, sort of tracking the relationship between the two and the very complicated domestic politics. Obviously, Italy signed the Memorandum of Understanding on BRI, but Salvini has been particularly critical of China, sort of taking the Trump position on it. Giovanna, I was wondering if you could maybe feel free to speak about maybe the impact of Biden, if he were to win on the transatlantic relationship, but particularly maybe focus on the China piece, just in terms of what Italy's stance will be. If Europe is becoming more skeptical, if it's becoming more competitive, there are greater investment controls, maybe greater concerns about Chinese money in Europe. Will Italy go along with that, or will it push back with other countries that have had a close economic relationship with Beijing?
Thank you, Tom. Yes, definitely. The debate is heated. As I was mentioning earlier, there are different views on China. And as you all know, Italy is always struggling with political instability. Indeed, looking at the bigger picture of Italy-China relations, it's important to look at also Europe relations with China and Chinese FDIs in Europe. So after the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding, I was actually wondering what was the rationale behind it, and of course how this plays out in the bigger Europe relations with China, and specifically finding out that of course Italy struggles attracting foreign direct investments and also struggles recovering from 2008, not just economic crisis but also risk adverse attitude for Italian investors to actually be able to boost economic growth, domestic economic growth. And that's why looking at China is actually has been for many entrepreneurs in Italy, in many sectors, from fashion to technology to also soccer, for that matter, looking at China as one of the most feasible options for not disappearing. And looking at the regulations that are in place, and if you look at how, for example, foreign direct investment in Italy are way lower than the ones Chinese foreign direct investment in Germany or France, it's also important to see the opportunities that Italy sees in it, but also the regulations that are in place in terms of protecting for Italian national security and national and assets from Chinese influence. And there is the so-called Golden Power Rule, which actually allows the government to veto any investment coming from a foreign country that risks to threat national security. And indeed, it's in place, and it has been recently extended to the telecommunications sector, so specifically targeting 5G. But of course, this is this is highly contingent on political will. There is no independent committee that can actually veto foreign direct investment as it happens in the US, but it's highly dependent on the government that is in power, what is the power struggle between the government coalition in this case. And looking at how this plays into Italy's relations with the US, it's important to note that for now, as far as the COVID-19 impact, there is no more that sort of big fascination with China as it used to be before. Even Five Star Movement, that has been very much pro-China, has kind of shifted a little bit towards a more pro-EU approach because, of course, of economic needs. But at the same time, there is a huge concern from the US side, especially after the withdrawal of troops from Germany, like the order of withdrawing troops from Germany, that actually threatens Italy's geopolitical projection, because Italy hosts the highest number of U.S. troops. It's 14,000 units of DoD in Italy, and it's the second largest contributor after the U.S. to NATO out-of-area operations. So sending the signal of disinterest from Europe and for European defense also sends a message not just to Italy in terms of trust, but also to U.S. competitors such as Russia and China. And I'll stop here.
Thank you. And we've gotten a couple of questions from the audience. So we'd encourage people, if they would like to ask questions, to use the hashtag BBTI. Fiona, I think these are sort of directed toward you, so I'll read them out. One is, how is the bipolar nature of US relations with Russia, such as withdrawing from open skies and putting pressure on New START, while also offering Russia the opportunity to rejoin the G7. How is all of that seen in Russia? How is it seen in Europe? And does it complicate transatlantic solidarity in response to threats and challenges from Russia? And then we also have a question which you could address, or anyone can address, on the panel, from Seth Johnson, who notes that previous upheavals in transatlantic relations often lead to the creation or modification of international institutions, such as the emergence of the G20 in the financial crisis, or the transformation of NATO after 9/11, or the expansion of the EU after the Cold War. And his question, Seth's question, is, will the impact of the pandemic also fit this trend? And if so, what changes to international institutions are likely to be most successful? And this, I think, is a little bit wrapped up in the discussion we had in the first session, on perhaps more sort of decoupling or diversification or like-minded countries working together. But Fiona, if you'd like to take one or both of those, and then we'll go to Amanda and Kamal as well.
Thanks so much. Those are great questions. I think they're kind of interrelated because, you know, again, I mean, Ivan and I and others are all touching on that same theme as of the end of that long cycle since World War II. And I think that last question of Seth's is really framed by, as we're saying, the transatlantic, and this is of course the theme of our discussion today, the transatlantic frame, which was the main frame from World War II to today. And, you know, we've been talking about Putin wanting to celebrate the 75th, you know, anniversary of the end of what Russia calls the Great Fatherland War. I mean, our idea of World War II. But, you know, the pandemic is truly global, and we've moved into a different phase now. We're talking about the shocks of globalization and all of the impacts that this is having on domestic politics. I mean, Giovanna's, you know, very cogent discussion here of how China has become a major factor in Italian politics. It might have been a major factor in Italian politics, you know, back in the day of Marco Polo, but, you know, certainly hasn't been for an extraordinarily long period of time, you know, since the end of the old, Silk Road and, you know, that trade. And although China ended up in permanent members of the United Nations Security Council at the end of World War II by, de facto at that point, really being part of the victors at the end of the war, because it was partly contested territory. And then, of course, China develops the nuclear weapons. It's taken a long time for China to actually rise up to that position. And a lot of that has been as a result of the deficiencies, frankly, of the transatlantic allies. So in terms of, Seth's question, I'm not so sure about how much of the old transatlantic institutions are going to be really impacted by the global pandemic. Obviously the World Health Organization that, the United States is, turning itself around the axle on at the moment, was one of the products of the World War II institutional creation to try to deal with all of the impacts that we had from the end of the war, including health crises. It was meant to be global, and I'm sure everybody else can come in on this as well, but it was, very much dominated by the big players, including the United States, again, underpinning this financially. And we've now seen that the US is no longer willing to take that kind of stance. And, picking up on Madeleine Albright's idea of, the US is the indispensable power, we actually see that when the United States does take away funding and, moves away from its support for these institutions, that they go into crisis. So we're in a larger crisis, as Ivan is mentioning here, where the United States is moving out of its previous role. And we're really seeing, no one else coming up to take its place. So I actually, think that will be a very different set of institutional arrangements that will come out of this. And, we'll have to, kind of still wait to see, how things play out over the longer term. And this is actually where the whole bipolar nature of US-Russia relations also fits into. Obviously, that's been a very important factor since the 1980s in terms of arms control and the efforts to find a way of moving forward on nuclear relations. I'm very sorry, I hope everybody can't hear this, but my daughter and the dog, this kind of gets to show the inability of anyone to control events. The dog's barking, my daughter's shouting at the dog in the background. I think that's kind of somehow seems emblematic of the problems that we're yes, I have no control over anything anymore. So the sleeping dog is no longer sleeping and is now barking everywhere. The US-Russia nuclear discussions or the old treaties, open skies, START and everything, INF and what comes next, are all taking place in a much more complex, multipolar world. China has not yet risen to the same level as the United States and Russia on in terms of its strategic arsenal. It's still considerably far behind, but it's obviously moving apace. But China is a major player in the intermediate nuclear forces. Obviously, the whole balance in the Asia-Pacific is dominated by perceptions of China and what its role might be and what China may be thinking about nuclear weapons. But we've got so many other nuclear players, and we have countries like Turkey and others often talk about wanting to have their own nuclear arsenal as well, not just be the host of US tactical nuclear missiles. So we have to really kind of factor in there about how we deal with this much more complex multipolar system. And that was really where we were headed off over the last several years. And I think, in terms of Russia's perspective on this, there's still a role to play. The US and Russia still have the largest strategic arsenals. But that is also, again, an old Cold War frame. And I think, what Ivan said about the possibility of a Biden presidency and the idea of, going back, it's impossible now. We are no longer in a 1980s world. We're not in a 1990s world, and we're not in a 2000s world. And even, the world of the 2010s is gone. We're in a whole new phase, so everything is going to have to be rethought. How it comes out is, I think, all up for debate.
Thank you, Fiona. So we just have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to go to Amanda and Kamal before we finish up. And Amanda, you know, feel free to address those questions from the audience. We also got a couple of additional questions in. Noah Barkin from the German Marshall Fund asked for a sense for how the Biden administration would approach transatlantic cooperation on China. Clearly the tone would change, Noah says, but would you expect a push for structured or comprehensive US-EU dialogue on China, and would a broader D10 approach make more sense? What about the future of the China debate within NATO? And Kamal, this question is for you from Kay Chirinsky. You mentioned, she says, that ideally countries should help refugees in their double emergency by adopting a shared burden response to absorb and help refugees. Do you think, she says, this is realistic considering the backlash across Europe from Germany's open door policy in 2015 and the subsequent solidification of external EU borders, which is still prominent today? So two great questions there. Amanda, maybe you could take the China one from Noah and maybe also just address this change in British foreign policy over the last few weeks, even with Hong Kong, with, you know, over 5G, where, you know, the UK used to be very, very accommodating towards China and very engaged, and Cameron and even, you know, Boris Johnson spoke about much greater relations post-Brexit with China. But now it seems to be in a very different place. So could you maybe just give us your thoughts on that, please?
Sure. I think China is going to remain a difficult issue for the transatlantic relationship. I think that there is becoming bipartisan concern here in Washington about China. And so I think for a lot of people in Europe, there is a recognition that the Democrats are not necessarily going to be taking a softer position or a more nuanced position on China, even if the rhetoric of a new administration would be softer on this than what Trump has had. And so I think Europe is going to find itself in the same situation in terms of being pressured to try and respond to some of the threats that the United States has identified. And some of this gets back toward what Yvonne was saying, which I think is a really real concern within Europe about the potential of either becoming irrelevant or about being squeezed between the United States and China and being seen as having to take sides. And some of that relates to Tom's question then about what's happening in the UK. Boris Johnson, as Fiona was alluding to, is suffering from domestic politics. And for him, there's this very real imperative to try and develop and deliver on an effective political and economic system within the UK post-Brexit to show that it was worthwhile. One of those goals has been to try and get nationwide internet broadband by 2025. And so that was part of the rationale for going forward with Huawei, which was an existing technology and a way of delivering that much more quickly. Obviously, there was a lot of resistance coming from the United States on this. And Tom, as you alluded to, you have seen the UK within the last couple of weeks talking about the possibility of wanting to get Huawei out of their internet system completely now by 2023, which helps fulfill that geopolitical aim of dealing with China, but is going to create problems delivering on this domestic goal of getting nationwide broadband by 2025. So it's a very real example of where geopolitics and national domestic politics are intersecting. The UK, as you said, is also getting very caught up in this broader situation within the UK or within Hong Kong, given Britain's own colonial legacy there. The UK coming out relatively quickly with the US, Canada, and Australia on a situation dealing with a statement dealing with the security law in Hong Kong. And also especially interesting in the context of Brexit, where so much of that was influenced by immigration, coming out and suggesting that upwards of 2 million people in Hong Kong who have the right to get passports in the UK because of that pre-97 status could potentially get extendable visas within the UK. So I think Boris Johnson is facing a much murkier situation in terms of China than where he was before, in terms of dealing with some of the historical legacy, dealing with some of the geopolitical implications of what's happening on the ground there, dealing with a very real interest to get a trade deal with the United States, with the subject of Huawei and British relations with China continuing to come up in bilateral trade talks that are going on, as well as the domestic economic imperative to try and deliver on social services in the wake of Brexit.
Amanda, thank you. Thank you very much for that. And Kamal, the last words to you, really. We only have a couple of moments, so we'll try to keep it brief. But, you know, the question is basically Europe is basically done with, you know, the refugee crisis. There's been a crackdown after 2015. So why should we expect this time to be different? Why do you think Europe is capable of maybe a more sort of enlightened, generous sort of approach to this issue?
That was a very good question. And I suppose it's not very realistic to expect that kind of cooperation. But I'd like to point out how this particular issue is also very much linked to what Fiona called the end of a long cycle. And it is a manifestation of how the values that the European Union had long stood for is weakening. And within the European Union, I see divisions. On the one hand, I think the EU as such, its institutions, both the European Parliament and the Commission, would like to take a, let me call it, a more generous, a more cooperative position on immigration in the broader sense and refugee issues in the more narrower sense of the word. But member states are very much divided amongst themselves, often driven by domestic political considerations. But on the other hand, there is also this problem out there, a real problem, a burden that needs to be shared. And if not shared, there could be consequences on the European Union's own security concerns. We saw that manifestation of it in 2015-16 crisis, and it impacted domestic politics in the European Union tremendously in a very major manner and undermining the values that I made references to. The way I see it, I think in the European Union, there are circles, actors wanting to be more cooperative on this issue, and then there are others who are resisting it. And we see that with respect to The minister Donohoe pointed out how solidarity came forward with respect to stimulus packages after some hesitation. But when it comes to sharing the burden of refugees within the European Union, there are problems. And very recently, the European Court of Justice ruled that Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary were in violation of EU rules and decisions and regulations on that issue. So before I end, Tom, with your permission, I need to say a very quick couple of words about Turkey and the geopolitics of all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so Kamal, we're just about out of time, so maybe just 30 seconds on Turkey.
Yeah. I think on Turkey was a solid ally of that long cycle that Fiona made references to. Now what we're seeing is a Turkey drifting away, but on the other hand, economically very much still tied to the West, but a government that is resisting it. It handled the pandemic crisis reasonably well, but opened up early. Early in June, number of cases were down to under 800, and yesterday they were double that number, almost 1600. The economic situation in Turkey has driven the need to open up the country from the pandemic lockdown, but the solutions to the economic problems of Turkey lie very much in closer cooperation with the old West, let's say, but that cooperation is not there, and I think it has a lot to do with that end of the long cycle, creating lots of challenges for Turkey, but for its previous allies as well.
Thank you, Kemal. Thank you, and sorry to cut you a little short. It's just a sign of the terrific discussion that we're basically beyond our time, but I'd like to thank you, Giovanna, Fiona, and Amanda for a wonderful discussion. We're going to move directly in to our third session, which is on practical areas for transatlantic cooperation during and after the COVID-19 crisis. And I will transfer to my colleague, Jim Golgar, who is a professor of international relations at the School of International Service at American University, and also is our Robert Bosch non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. So Jim, thank you for doing this, and I will hand it over to you to introduce our next panel.
Great, thanks so much, Tom. What a terrific panel you just had, and really looking forward to our next group starting up. They are coming onto the screen right now. As Tom mentioned, I'm Jim Goldgeier, Robert Bosch Senior Visiting Fellow at Brookings. This next panel is called Prospects for Transatlantic Cooperation After COVID-19. And we're joined by four terrific colleagues, Celia Bellin, Visiting Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings, Mark Leonard, the co-founder and director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, Molly Montgomery, non-resident fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings and vice president of the Albright Stonebridge Group, and Victoria Newland, non-resident senior fellow, Center on the United States and Europe and senior advisor to the director of foreign policy at Brookings and also a senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. I have asked each panelist in advance if they could kick things off with one thing they'd like to see put front and center to help rebuild the transatlantic relationship. And if they can, also say concretely how they would pursue that objective. And so we're going to start with Celia and then go on from there.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having us today. Thank you to Bosch and Brookings for organizing this great half day. So to answer your question, Jim, I've thought about what is the one thing that transatlantic allies should do post-COVID. And I think that's not exactly the question, because the first priority should be to overcome the COVID crisis, first and foremost. And I don't think we are at this stage right now. So the priority to rebuild the transatlantic relationship, but also to get out of the crisis, should be that Americans and Europeans should work together on securing a universal access to tests, treatments, and vaccines. And Europeans, by and large, have supported UN efforts to do so. You know about the ACT Accelerator Initiative at the UN, which is an initiative that is put together with the WHO, with Gavi, Unitaid, but also the Gates Foundation, and a whole lot of a public-private partnership, pharmaceuticals and labs. And the goal there is to accelerate the development and the production of tests, of treatments, and of vaccines, and to ensure a just distribution. And I think the U.S. has to get on board. So far, it has been reticent to do so. But it would be a building block for a healthier transatlantic relationship as well. I think it's not just the moral thing to do, but it's also based on self-interest, because no one can be really immune to the virus until there's a place somewhere where the virus thrives. So after the previous panel, where we saw most of our colleagues, Ivan, Fiona, Giovanna, Amanda, Kemal, talking about the sort of crisis of leadership of the U.S. and the difficulties there is to trust the U.S. again, the only way to get back in the game, in particular in case of a change of administration, but in general, it would be for the U.S. to get on board with a collective, coordinated multilateral response to the crisis. In a second phase, I think beyond the immediate pandemic that we are in, there will be questions, larger questions of transatlantic cooperation to build a new growth model, a new economic model for the transatlantic sphere that is based on more resilient society, that is based on diversifying of supply chains, that is also tackling the most important global challenges that will come up, including climate change, and then reinventing the world order. But that would be the third step, right? And maybe this will only come once other multilateral types of response are really taken on board by both Europeans and Americans and putting the stones for building this new world order. I'll stop there and happy to continue on those ideas.
Great. Thanks so much for getting us started here. And Mark, we'll turn things to you now. Welcome. And don't forget.
Thanks so much for inviting me to take part in this. It's pretty obvious what the one thing which Americans can do to improve the transatlantic relationship is, which is to vote for Joe Biden in November. Once that happens, there are a bunch of different candidates for things that Biden could do which would improve the relationship. Starting with global trade, agreeing a joint agenda to save the WTO's appellate body, working out a common reform agenda, rejoining Paris Climate Accord, helping to come up with a common approach towards Russia, which includes containing Russian aggression and finding ways of engaging Russia on neighborhood security problems, returning to the JCPOA and working with Europeans to help get Iran to start complying, possibly coming up with some sort of digital tax agreement so that doesn't become a festering issue, removing the kind of structural irritant of secondary sanctions, which make Europeans feel that global public goods are being instrumentalized and weaponized and turned into instruments of American foreign policy. There's a long list of things you could do, but and I was sort of talking to my colleagues about what they would start with and how to go forward, and then got around to a conversation with Jeremy Shapiro, who shares a Brookings as well as an ECFR identity. And he said that you're asking us all the wrong question because you're treating transatlantic relations as an end in themselves rather than a tool to protect the interests and to improve the lives of people on both sides of the Atlantic. And that the right question to ask is not how to improve transatlantic relations, but how could transatlantic relations be most useful in helping Europeans and Americans meet our foreign policy goals? So if you're answering that question, then it seems to me that the big question is to do with China. It's obviously been the biggest issue for the US for a long time now, and increasingly it's for Europeans. But the prospect of finding a joined up approach in the longer term does seem very complicated, because from a European perspective, that does mean essentially coming to a shared understanding of how to push back on the Chinese model of political economy, because the coming together of Made in China 2025 with China Standards 2035 and the Belt and Road Initiative doesn't just change the nature of globalization in an uncomfortable way within the Chinese market, but threatens to export the Chinese model of political economy to every single economy in the world, and creates an unlevel playing field, which we're all kind of dealing with. And that means there is a sort of huge agenda which one could work together with. And I think there's been a big change in perceptions of China in many European countries recently. But at the same time, I think there are enormous differences of interest between Europeans and Americans. And that's why actually at the moment, most Europeans want a less rather than a more joined up approach to China, because they're scared of getting sucked into an unwinnable quest to maintain US military supremacy in the Indo-Pacific. And I think that question about what our respective visions of the ultimate world order are and how to get there is going to be the key to finding a new agenda for the West and for the transatlantic relationship. But it's something which is much more complicated than simply replacing the current incumbent of the White House, because there are some fundamental structural questions which underlie the easy part of our China policy, which is getting tougher. Because I don't feel that there is a sort of shared sense of where people want to land in Washington or in the rest of the US, even though everyone is agreed that we need to move towards a more kind of robust and less sort of faith-based convergence wager model of policy towards China. And on the European side, I also don't think that there is a realistic idea of what kind of world we want to live in, given that the sort of multilateral Kantian paradise which most Europeans would like to live in seems quite difficult to realize, while Putin's sitting in the Kremlin and Xi Jinping's in Zhongnanhai and Modi is in India and Erdogan's in Turkey, not to mention the current incumbent in the White House.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Mark. And thanks for getting Jeremy in there to critique us from the sidelines. That's excellent. It's always good to hear from him, even if indirectly. And great to hear your thoughts on China and how that fits into the transatlantic relationship, which I believe Molly would like to continue that focus of the conversation. So please, Molly, over to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. And thanks to Brookings and Bosch for putting on this great event. I've really enjoyed the panels so far. I feel like Mark stole all my talking points, so I will be fairly brief. But I wanted to start out by just highlighting a couple of obstacles, because I think it's absolutely right that we need to think about transatlantic relations both as an end unto themselves, but then also where do we go from here? And I am definitely concerned that as we look to the end of 2020 and into 2021, there really are a lot of headwinds in terms of trying to turn the page. So obviously this European Commission wants to be more geopolitical, I think is still trying to figure out what that means, but also is very much interested in trying to defend the single market, enhance competition, et cetera. And where that really comes to a head beginning at the end of this year is with the digital agenda. And so I think we all should keep an eye on that as we move forward, since in the fourth quarter of this year, we're going to see a number of initiatives coming from Brussels that are going to lead to a real fight between US tech giants and the European Union. And so as we look to potentially a new administration in January, that's going to really leave a very small needle to thread in terms of trying to change the tone of transatlantic relations while not appearing to be a pushover on U.S. interests, and at the same time dealing with all of these very thorny issues in terms of disinformation and online harms, tax issues related to the digital economy, liability, competition, etc. And so I think that digital agenda is going to be something key as we look at how does the U.S., even in a new administration, approach that so that it isn't allowed to become a huge stumbling block. The other thing I would say is trade is, as Mark said, something that we need to keep an eye on, because certainly there's likely to be a change in tone. And I don't think from a Biden administration we would see the kind of rhetoric on tariffs, et cetera. But are we willing to recommit to a multilateral framework? Are we, as Celia talked about, trying to find a new way forward? And are we really looking to do that together rather than just focusing on the festering bilateral trade irritants that always exist? And so what I would say is that the US and Europe are always best when we're focused on our shared values and when we have a common goal that is external to the transatlantic relationship. And so in that, I really agree with Jeremy. And I absolutely agree, Mark, that shared goal needs to be vis-a-vis China. There clearly are difficulties in terms of finding that shared perspective. As Mark mentioned, both in terms of the military component in the US, and I would say in the EU on the participation of an increasing number of member states in Belt and Road who have an effective veto over EU policy. But if we look at finding a shared way forward on China as an overarching theme of improved transatlantic relations, it really does incentivize us to find ways forward on digital issues, on trade issues, on other thorny issues that are going to be more collaborative than adversarial. And I think that's really important as we look to really turn the page, to change the tone, and to try to develop some trust and positive muscle memory on both sides of the Atlantic moving forward.
Great, thanks so much, Molly. And Toria, over to you.
If I can learn to unmute my audio. Good to see everybody, particularly Mark from across the pond. Glad we've got some gender diversity on this panel as well. Look, I agree with everybody that rebuilding transatlantic relations is urgent, it's mutually beneficial, and frankly, it's existential now if we want to ensure that the global system that we built together continues to favor free nations, free trade, and the values that we share, and is not hijacked by others with another agenda. I think the most existential issue, the most urgent issue, is that we build back better together in a way that is greener, that is more innovative, and that addresses the income inequality that has begun to corrode confidence in our democratic systems. And at the end of the day, thank you, Jeremy, yes, it's about a commitment to shared prosperity and shared security and a belief that we are stronger together. I obviously agree with Mark that it would help if the incumbent in the White House believed in those things. And as long as we have somebody in the White House who believes that we have been, that America's been ripped off by Europe rather than sharing these fundamental objectives, goals, and requirements, it's going to be very, very difficult. That said, look, I think as we look at the economic rebuilding, we have not done as well as we could have with COVID relief funds because we didn't coordinate the fiscal and financial and monetary response. So, you know, getting back to a place where we are working together on creating the environment for economic growth, for stimulating our businesses, where we are harnessing technology together in affirmative ways for small business, medium business, for innovation, getting more of the have-nots into the tech economy, whether it's stimulating broadband, whether it's retraining and job growth, and where all of these things are as green as they possibly can be. And there I want to salute what Europe is doing in tying relief funds and giving incentives for green rebuilding. And we've seen the U.S. states try to be a partner to Europe in that. And I also think it makes it harder for China to compete when we do all these things well together. Obviously, the other two issues, technology and China, as addressed by others. On the tech side, I do not think that it is an insurmountable issue for any American president to have a strong conversation with Europe, with the democracies of Asia, about an appropriate regime of responsible regulation, taxation, responsibility, innovation, disinformation, blocking of incitement, and set up left-right limits in partnership with the technology companies and with the best researchers on this so that we protect a digital economy that favors free nations and block and tackle the effort by authoritarians to exploit this potential major driver of growth, of equality, of strength for our democracies. But we have to be committed to that as part of our shared prosperity and our shared security, and it requires U.S. leadership It's not the right approach for Europeans to, try to squeeze the U.S. companies to the wall, and it's not the right approach for the U.S. companies to do as little as possible until they're forced. It has to be looked at as a whole. And similarly on China, I don't think anybody's going to ask Europe to help defend the Pacific, at least not now, at least not in a non-war circumstance. But by the same token, if we don't have a joint approach to state-owned enterprises, to competition, to transparency, to reciprocity, there's no reason for China to stop trying to change the rules of the road and to stop trying to eat free nations from the inside by buying and acquiring their technology, their infrastructure, et cetera. So here again, if the Trump administration had accepted Europe's offer to enter the trade talks together, the U.S. economy would have suffered less. We would have been able to work together with Europeans on left-right limits for Chinese economic engagement in our markets, and we would have begun this process of coordinating a regime that allows China the legitimate benefits of engaging with the international system, but doesn't allow them to change the fundamental rules along the way or corrode democratic principles. We may not get that electoral change. So, picking up on where Molly was, I do think that Europeans have to think about how they want to use this year and how they want to position themselves for whatever comes in January 2021. And I share some of the concerns that Europe needs to be careful not to copycat the bad habits of the Trump administration. In other words, as it looks at industrial champions, as it looks at industrial policy, as it looks at the deal with the UK, as it looks at the deal with the US, we should be favoring open markets, freer trade, not building walls between ourselves, because that is just going to allow us to be a feast for the authoritarians rather than to strengthen the system that we want them to adhere to. So we just need to be careful there. And similarly, on the Digital Services Act, it would be a wonderful thing if Europe could use this time where we're trying to figure out where we're going to set the standards for greener build back, to set the standards for appropriate technology regulation that we can slip into and join as a good conversation in January. But there are also risks that Europe is not itself committed anymore to free trade, free people, free markets, free global system, and that it will learn these wrong lessons. And that takes me to the last point, which is simply defending democracy within Europe. I think you would see a Biden administration care a whole lot more about the quality of its allies' internal defense of democracy, whether it's in Turkey or whether it's in Hungary or Poland, and be more assertive with Europe as we seek to rebuild those strengths inside the United States, that we need to rebuild them inside Europe too. And then the three-legged stool of the US, UK, and the EU, which has to be, particularly on the security side, thought of as a new form of collective. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much, Toria. And we have about half an hour left before we will turn things over to the next session. Just a reminder that folks can use the hashtag BBTI or email events@brookings.edu to ask questions. And we do have some questions coming in that I'm going to use to help flesh out some of this discussion. We had a question from Robert Moreland, former MEP. Is the only answer a change of president? And Celia, I want to sort of add on to that question slightly, which is you can answer whether it's only a change of president that is the answer. But even if there's a change of president, that's still not enough. I mean, given where things have gone in the transatlantic relationship, even if there's a change on January 20th, it's not going to be sufficient for the United States to say, we're back, so let's rejuvenate transatlantic relations. What do you think Europe and France in particular will be looking for from the United States in terms of a recognition of what's been done to the relationship over the last several years?
So, of course, a change in president would help. Let's be frank, at this point, there's such difficulties and such an amount of irritants, both at the moment, but also long-term, that have built under the Trump administration, that I think a change of president and a change of team behind the president would help. And I think at this point, European powers are actually hoping for it, let's be frank. However, there's also a recognition that some of what happened in the past 3 years will not be forgotten, and a longer conversation about the evolution of US foreign policy. So first of all, there's a few constants that I think we can expect from US foreign policy, whether it's a Biden or a Trump administration, that Europeans will have to reckon with. For example, the increasing rivalry with China, and the fact that Europeans are all too often expected to follow, expected to be on one side, and are monitored for picking a side, rather than this China policy being built together, as Mark said and Molly said, as a goal for building a new world order together with partners, and not just Europeans expected to fall in line. I think there's a question on the arc of the crisis that the French are particularly interested in, but Europeans in general along the Sahel and the Middle East region, on whether Americans would be supportive and engaged in counterterrorism efforts, or in securing a prosperous and safe Middle East. There's been a talk at all levels, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. There's a disinterest, I believe, for these questions. At least the question will be put back on what will be U.S. engagement on this. There's also a simple question of, a depleted administration that a lot of colleagues here at Brookings that know very well the State Department and other places within the administration explain there's a lot of rebuilding to be done so as to be able to have an efficient U.S. diplomacy sort of back on the world stage. And until that's done, and that's probably going to take a while, and there's going to be domestically focused interest on part of this administration, I think it's going to impede efforts by the Biden administration if it wants to sort of re-engage in the world. But my last point, and I think what's really expected of the U.S. at this point, is really a re-engagement into multilateral organization, into multilateral institution, into the kind of institution that will outlive a simple administration. Because one of the lessons that we've learned for the past 20 years is that there is such a pendulum swing between administrations, depending if it's a Republican sort of more neoconservative administration that is trying to promote democracy abroad, or a Democratic administration that is pivoting to China, to then another administration that will impose its nationalistic and protectionist foreign policy, that whatever is expected of another yet administration will not be trusted as durable, will not be trusted as sustainable option for allies to engage with. Because once again, it could be just defeated by the next administration coming along. So who at this stage, whether it's Iranians or whether it's Europeans, who would engage in a bilateral discussion with Americans anymore? I think it's not going to happen. And so Americans need to fully understand that, and understand that institution, multilateral organization, would serve their purpose and help them, even if they're difficult to build, even if sometimes they don't serve their interest, even if we're talking about criminal justice that might, gets them nervous. There's a lot to say about the the amounts of sustainability that they would bring to their own interest in re-engaging. Having a clear, if we take only the health issue, having international health regulations really put in place and strengthened with inspections, for example, would prevent the next pandemic, or at least allow for more transparency and less manipulation maybe by less transparent actors. Or if we have more de-escalation mechanism and at the more peace security level, that would prevent also future crisis to unravel and just dependence on the goodwill of the American president. So by and large, I think there's a recognition of too large a pendulum swing, and Europeans would really expect and hope for the next administration to understand that fact.
Great, thank you. Well, of course, one of the major institutions that the United States helped to found and has played such an important role in is NATO. And Toria, we have a question from Andrew Adair that I'm going to build on. The question is, what are the prospects of joint strategic reserves for medical supplies? And I just wanted to build on that. We saw that NATO played some role in airlifting supplies. When we talk about these sort of broader definitions of national security to include health issues, and going back to Mark's earlier point via Jeremy about thinking about making the case for why transatlantic relations serves the interests of the United States and the Europeans, how do you see us? How do you see people in the United States who believe NATO has an important role making that case for NATO as it goes forward? And do you see it playing a role in these broader issues, so for example, strategic reserves for medical supplies, or is that for a different institution to deal with?
Well, as a former NATO ambassador and somebody who spent 6 years working in the organization, I'm always going to be a NATO champion. It is the only standing body where the U.S. sits with Canada and all of its major democratic European partners, and now the U.K. as it pulls out of the EU, in a permanent conversation, not simply about hard security issues, but ideally also about all the strategic challenges that we face together. And I believe that NATO should be a format where we do more talking about China, where we do more talking, frankly, about economics, even though NATO doesn't have competency on it, and about a broader definition of security, as you've noted here, Jim, which includes public health. However, I've also long been a fan of greater NATO-EU collaboration coordination. Way back in 2007, in a speech in Paris with George W. Bush's agreement, I called for a NATO-EU fusion center, because in the European context, it is the EU that has competence over health, has competence over innovation, has competence over economic issues. And frankly, we need to, as a democratic family, be pulling all of these tools of the trade together if we're going to strengthen ourselves and prepare for the next crisis, no matter where it comes from. It's not going to be a simply hard military crisis as we've seen. So if we could get over the Greek-Turkey objections, and frankly, I think this should be a major demand of the United States and of the UK, we could move more of our transatlantic conversation to an entity, a NATO-EU fusion, that would have both all the members and all the tools. Then you get to the question of how do you include Asian allies, the Asian democracies, Japan, Korea, Australia. I would also like to see the G7 have some standing capacity, not just come together when foreign ministers meet three times a year, or finance ministers meet, or heads meet, and have some permanent conversation there. I think all of these things are essential for ensuring that we as a free community defend what we have, advance it, strengthen our communities and our societies and their commitment to what democracy brings, and block and tackle authoritarians. Last point on NATO, No matter how easy it is in every generation, in every decade, to bash NATO, it is the only multilateral organization that has completely changed its mission, its outlook, its toolkit to adapt to changing circumstances, first going into the Balkans, then going into Afghanistan, then getting into the training business, whether it was in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And it's proven its resilience to do that. When Celia talks about a renewed U.S. commitment to multilateralism, I think multilateral institutions that actually pay security and prosperity benefits, as the WTO did, as NATO has, are some that we will certainly want to reinvest in, but not just for the sake of saying that we're trying to solve a problem or to buy time for the authoritarians to stall, as they do in the UN, as they do too often in the WTO, or to take lowest common denominator justice, which is often unfair and unjust.
Great, thanks. So Mark, Turia mentions NATO, EU collaboration, especially from her perspective as a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. What does NATO-EU collaboration look like from your perspective, and even sort of a more enhanced U.S.-EU relationship? What do you think is the appetite in Europe?
I think the Europeans obviously were very keen on the status quo ante of being able to benefit from the American security blanket with only minimal investments in their own security. So the closest that they can bring things to that, the better for many member states. But however, I think that Trump has been very successful in creating a degree of uncertainty about American security guarantees, which has actually led to quite a healthy discussion about European defense, which has still been somewhat symbolic and more focused on the defense industrial side rather than actually building real capabilities. And I think now that COVID's come, it might help Europeans meet their 2% targets simply by shrinking the size of their economies. But I suspect this isn't going to be the number one priority in many countries as part of their reconstruction and rebuilding. But I do think that from an American perspective, having a more capable and grown up and integrated EU side would be very helpful. But that is something which is going to be a sort of long-term project. Brexit obviously makes it that much more complicated. The British government is very reluctant to enter into institutional cooperation around foreign policy and defence issues with the EU. The nature of the UK-EU relationship is going to be relatively unclear. That might actually, in a strange way, enhance the importance of NATO, because it is the one institutional structure where Britain and the EU27, well, not all of the EU27, but a large number of EU27 countries are sitting. I think what this shows is that we're going to have quite complicated, messy arrangements, both to deal with the intra-European questions and to think about the EU-US questions. I mean, NATO hasn't been a particularly useful forum for the strategic conversation, which we need to be having about the nature of the world for a long time now. It's been a very useful toolkit for different players, and Turkey's role within NATO is also another complicating factor, which makes that strategic political dialogue between Europeans and Americans more complicated and makes NATO a less obvious place to have it at the very highest levels. So I think it's quite a complicated question to answer, which is why I've been rambling for a long time, because we have this sort of deep structural changes to the nature of the world and global order, which we're all trying to digest. That's going hand in hand with what I think is going to be a very important reworking of how globalization works post-COVID. And then you have the sort of internal politics, both in the US and in European countries, which is leading to quite different ways of framing these issues. And that those internal political conversations are still working their way through. Brexit is one component of that, but the politics in lots of EU member states are also very much up in the air. And I think the sort of the nature of the answer to your question will depend a lot on whether Emmanuel Macron is still sitting in the Élysée, who's running Italy, because you could see various quite different scenarios on the European side as well as in the White House. And in the absence of clear answers to that, it's difficult to know whether NATO debate is going to go forward, because it's unlikely to lead to the sort of reinvention that Tories talking about if Trump wins the elections or if some of these other people win the elections on the European side.
Thanks so much, Mark. Molly, one issue that we really haven't addressed yet in any detail is Russia and how Russia figures in either as a vehicle to foster greater U.S.-Europe collaboration or as a vehicle for undermining U.S.-Europe collaboration. And wonder if you could speak for a few minutes about that issue from your perspective.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim. I would say it will probably continue to be both moving forward. And I think we've seen that tension play out in a number of ways over the last few months, whether you look at what was quite a de facto rollover of EU sanctions, which are parallel to the US sanctions related to Russia's invasion of Crimea and Eastern Ukraine in 2014. You see there that there is continued solidarity and a desire to impose costs on Russia for continued bad behavior with respect to Ukraine. At the same time, we definitely have seen kind of a dissipation of cooperation between the United States and European partners, as well as, I would say, between European partners and Ukraine on the way forward on those issues. But I think Ukraine in particular, vis-a-vis Russia, will continue to be an area where there is scope for transatlantic cooperation. At the same time, the economic issues do tend to be where we see differences. That's been a perennial issue with Germany in terms of Nord Stream 2, and there are other countries as well, such as Italy, Spain, particularly those that are likely to be hardest hit in these times economically due to COVID, have also tended to be some of the weakest on Russia. So I think we'll continue to see those dynamics play out, where from a political lens, there is reason to work together vis-a-vis Russia, but from an economic lens, particularly for countries that really would stand to benefit from greater trade, et cetera, you will see that there continues to be that tension. I think it is also important to note that Russia itself is really in the midst of a period of uncertainty. Obviously, it's been very hard hit by the pandemic, and we've also seen that the pandemic has really taken the timeline of Putin's expected rubber stamping of his potential to continue on for the foreseeable future in leadership. It's extended that. His popularity is lower than it has been during his time in leadership. And so while I don't expect there to be a major sea change in Russia, I think it bears keeping in mind that this is also a period in which Russia is focused internally. Traditionally, that has meant that we should watch out for Russia to lash out and potentially try to distract from those internal issues. But it's certainly worth paying attention to how those things develop.
Toria, there's a question that came in from Valeria Yegizman, a journalist with the Voice of America in the Russia division, that really follows on where Molly ended her remarks, and it was directed to you. And it's, what steps do you see Russia taking with regard to transatlantic relations vis-a-vis the EU, the US, especially if relations remain strained between the United States and Europe?
He's asking me to predict Russia policy. Is that what I'm hearing here? Yeah.
Yes. What do you see as steps Russia might take?
I work very hard not to get inside Putin's head. It's not a very pretty place. So I don't know that I'm going to predict on what Russia is going to do. I agree with Molly that one has to watch out for the lash out when they're under pressure. That said, I think it's up to us. It depends on what we do. Do we stay strong in insisting that good relations with us demand that Russia stop its predatory behavior around the world, whether it is interfering in our elections, killing its adversaries on our soil, standing with the dictators in the likes and thugs in the likes of Syria and Libya and Venezuela, and whether it gets out of Ukraine. And we should, I believe, work on a strong package together as a transatlantic community of what better relations could look like, including trade benefits, et cetera, and put it in the shop window for Russia and make it clear that we are not looking for a permanent enemy. In fact, we're looking for better cooperation, but you have to live by global civilized standards if you want to benefit from trade and good political relations with us. So I think it really depends on us. I do think that Putin will jam through his fourth coronation or his presidency for life, but I also think that it's not delivering for average Russians, and that this COVID period will prove once again that he will feed and feather the nests of his capos before he takes care of the Russian people, whether it's their health needs or their economic needs. And I think that will be corrosive inside Russia.
Great, thanks. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left, and I wanted to bring things back, Celia, to where you began with your thoughts on the fact that even though this panel is called Rebuilding Transatlantic Relations After COVID, we are still in the midst of COVID, and we're going to need strong transatlantic relations to get us through and on the other side of this pandemic. And just curious, sort of your feelings of optimism or pessimism regarding the prospects for the transatlantic relationship in this regard. What do you think the prospects are for doing the kinds of things that you were talking about when you started the conversation here?
Really, it's going to depend at some point on the election in terms of having a responsible partner with which to work on a global coordinated response to the pandemic. I think there is many proposal on the table that is coming from all sides, including to strengthen WHO. There is it's been a mistake from the Trump administration to advocate for to announce that they would cut their participation in WHO. It's the opposite that should be done. It should be strengthened, and imbalanced funding should be taken as an opportunity to increase the independence of the institution. If the US is really committed to avoid Chinese interference and Chinese capacity to influence too much these organizations, it should really reinvest in making them more transparent, more independent, and stronger. France, for example, had suggested creating a sort of IPCC for human and animal health. So some sort of expert groups at the highest level that would render scientific opinions independently and be able to prepare for the next pandemic. That's one of many examples that can be pushed forward for the U.S. to take on if there is a change in administration. If there's no change in administration, there are still opportunities for cooperation, but I think after this pandemic or during this pandemic, hopefully the administration will understand that it needs its partners, and not only for partners to just follow on with its own vision of geopolitics and strategic competition with China and Russia, but to build together a transatlantic strategic response to these challenges. It's geopolitics and domestic politics shouldn't be an excuse to weaken what we have in common, strong transatlantic relations. But it has, and it's a reality. It's going to take some rebuilding. Europe has to do its own homework. It has to focus internally, of course. But there are many opportunities, whether it's on health or on climate or on the digital challenge that Molly was talking about, and obviously on China through trade also. Many, many different areas of cooperation where only coordination and cooperation will be successful.
Well, I heard that is actually pretty optimistic. So either way, so ask Mark in the couple minutes we have remaining, since you were good enough to join us from Europe today for this session, whether you share that optimism that either way, the United States is going to figure out that they need this transatlantic partnership to be able to move forward successfully.
I am optimistic, because I think that Europeans have been on an extended sabbatical from geopolitics, which was unhelpful and made them into a very bad partner for the US, led to a kind of slightly cloying, infantilized relationship. And a lot of tensions during the good days. And now that things are less good, I think that Europeans are having to face up to the fragility of global order, the fact that we're going to be entering a very, very different sort of world, where their dreams of sort of universal multilateral institutions running everything are unlikely to become a reality. And that is leading to a different kind of debate within Europe about both what the nature of the European project is, which is, I think, very healthy, because the previous European project was very much about dealing with homegrown problems and defending Europeans, saving Europeans from themselves. Now, and therefore the debates about sovereignty were very much about pooling sovereignty and taking it away from member states, taming sovereignty. I think the new debates now are about strategic sovereignty, and it sees a kind of weaponized global order as a big threat to European sovereignty. And so the debates now are about whether you can recreate it, regain a sense of control in this world, by changing the nature of the European project. And that means Europeans both taking more responsibility for their own affairs, but also being more assertive and more ready to stand up for their interests, both by looking for more control over their economies, using regulation, using competition policy, using a lot of their own tools to forward their own agenda, but also being determined to get reciprocal arrangements with other players, not least with China. And if you think about the kind of big battlegrounds of the 21st century, whether it's about trade, whether it's about the global financial system, whether it's about the digital sphere, we have a kind of emerging debate where Europeans are going from being worried about being roadkill in a Sino-US game of chicken to actually seeing themselves as one of the big players in this world. And I think the 5G debate has been a very interesting example of that, where Europeans behaved as if they're caught between China and America, is in fact the only alternative to Huawei are European companies. And that has something which hasn't actually filtered into the way that Europeans think about that. And I think we could see that potentially happening in other areas. And if Europeans start to take more responsibility for themselves, I think that will lead the US to be more interested in the transatlantic relationship, because it will be less one-sided. It will be less about America providing for Europeans and more about a genuine partnership. And a lot of the rhetoric of the last few decades could actually end up becoming more real as we both face up to our shrinking share of the global GDP and of military spending, and the fact that the world is much less benign for the liberal values which we've inculcated in our domestic political systems.
Well, this has been a fantastic discussion. Thanks again to Bosch. Thanks to Celia, Mark, Molly, and Toria. Really appreciate you all joining on. And I now turn things over to my Brookings colleague, Constanza Stelzenmüller, for her discussion with the Spanish foreign minister.
Perfect. I'm so happy to see you. From my home in Washington, D.C., greetings to Madrid.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure and an honor to have you on, Señora Ministra Querida Arantxa, and I'm going to stop speaking Spanish. This is just a reference to my Spanish adolescence, 4 years in Madrid. As people will note who are watching this tremendous morning conference, this conversation has no gender diversity. It's two women talking about the future of Europe as seen from Spain. But I think that that is progress and a great way to end this, what has been a fabulous day. Our speaker today is Arantxa González Laya, the foreign minister of Spain, who in a country that has always, shall we say, energetically punched above its weight in European and NATO affairs with distinguished names like Javier Solana, Luis de Guindos, Josep Borrell, the current EU foreign minister, and is currently pitching his finance minister, Nadia Calviño, as the next head of the Eurogroup, Arantxa González Laya is something of a triple threat. She is Basque, and the Basques are known as being both fiercely local and very entrepreneurial internationalists, as the distribution of Basque names across America and Latin America shows. She is a lawyer and she is a trade expert, having been chief of staff to Pascal Lamy, both at the EU Commission and at the World Trade Organization. So it's an enormous privilege to have you with us today. And let me ask you something, if I may, very personal, because we're all just so slowly crawling out of the seclusion of our homes into the light and back into society and our workplaces. So let me ask you, what's it like to run your country's foreign policy from your home?
Well, first of all, Constance, thank you very much for your kind words to start this conversation. COVID has been an incredible experience to all of us. It certainly has been an experience to me. I landed in Spain 20 years after having left my country to become the foreign minister on the 11th of January. And on the 14th of March, we had declared a state of alarm in Spain to fight COVID. And I live next door to my office. So I was basically running the foreign affairs of the country from an empty ministry in an empty city with empty streets. Something very unusual in a country like Spain, and certainly very unusual when you live in the center of Madrid's old town. But I guess what made this a very specific situation and a very specific crisis, I've lived through crises before in my life. I saw the 2008 financial crisis, I saw Ebola and SARS before that. But never had a crisis hit us so hard, so fast, so deep. Never had we experienced this sense of fragility. And I sense this fragility because COVID hit also my family. So this was a very personal feeling that I had. At the same time, realizing learning two things very, very fast. One was that globally, we are not, we still are not today, but we were not prepared to face a pandemic in a world that is hugely interconnected. The responses were always especially at the beginning, and to some extent still today, very national, very local, very limited. But the reality is that this is also a crisis that affects interconnectedness, so it's not enough. And the second one was a realization that for a country like Spain, part of the European Union, this was also, it became clear also that we needed a very rapid European response, not just a rapid Spanish response, which we did with a state of alarm on the 14th of March, just a day and a half after the WHO had declared a world pandemic, but that we needed also a very solid and strong European response that at the beginning, let's say, was a bit hesitant. It became stronger with time. So from a very personal experience of these days, trying to grapple as part of the Spanish government with the sanitary first big set of health measures, but also investing a lot in keeping jobs and workers on board while they were confined in their homes. A very funny feeling I have.
Let me. We need to talk about the European and international aspects of all this, but let me perhaps just to stay for a moment with the impact of the pandemic in Spain. Spain was one of the hardest hit countries in Europe, with nearly 250,000 cases of infections, more than 27,000 deaths, and I'm very sorry to hear that it had an impact on your family as well. My condolences. Why was Spain so hard hit? What do you think is what are the particularities why Spain had such a hard time? And let me just say that I, having lived in Spain and known, like you, just how important life on the streets, the cafes mm-hmm. and tertulias, the conversation, physical contact is for Spanish culture, it's astounding to me that the Spanish submitted courageously to a really hard lockdown, like the Italians and the French, while the Germans, who had a very light lockdown, were rioting on the streets complaining about Bill Gates. So why was Spain so hard hit?
Well, to be quite honest with you, this is something that we are having collectively a lot of troubling understanding. This is the hardest question for any epidemiologist. And this is a profession I've discovered on the occasion of COVID. And they themselves, and they are the experts that can decode for us what are the factors that most affect the transmission of a virus like COVID, are unable to give you straight answers. So what we have is a set of elements. Understanding again that how hard the country has been hit is even open for discussion, because we are not counting the same things depending on the country, and because it depends on how much we have tested, and because it depends on how we are counting those that are infected, those that are asymptomatic, those that are dead, those that died because of COVID versus those that died because of other circumstances. So with all these caveats, there are some elements that epidemiologists point at to try to explain what happened in Spain. One is obviously mobility. Spain is on the top 10 most mobile countries in the world, second largest recipient of tourists in the world, which means that it's a country where people mobility, which is a big vector of transmission of this virus, happens to be Spain. Second is probably, you mentioned it, social habits, our own life habits. Number three is density of population. There was a big concentration of COVID, especially at the beginning in Madrid, and not unlike what we've seen in the US with New York, or in the UK with London, or in France with Paris, or in Italy with Milan. Number four, there are many weather factors that, again, epidemiologists still are trying to grapple with, and longevity. Spain is one of those, one of the countries in the world with the longest life expectancy. So all of this together, combined, and probably many more, I would say that one of the factors that made Spain such a country was that the virus was circulating within the country well before we could identify that it was. So by the time, given its exponential growth, by the time we declared the state of alarm, probably it was further within the system that we ever thought it was. But, you know, this is part of what we will have to look at moving forward to understand, and through that to not repeat.
Do you think there might be a conversation in Europe to be had either at the EU level or among nation state governments about how we need to bolster our national resilience, institutional, economic, societal, against this kind of thing?
Absolutely, yes. Resilience is a word that has acquired new meaning with this pandemic. We are starting to understand what it means. It means that we have to be better prepared. We did, you know, in 2008, for example, we invented this concept of a stress test to our banks. That was to test the resilience of our banks. What we've understood now is that we have to stress test our healthcare systems because they need to be prepared to huge shocks, not normal shocks like you have every year when you have the flu season, but something that is extreme. So preparedness to face pandemics, especially with the healthcare systems, but also with our economic systems, will be very high on the agenda of the Spanish government. And we've made this also, together with some other European colleagues, part of the European priorities moving forward.
Good, excellent. I think that sounds like a really good innovation going forward. Let me move very quickly to the European level of this pandemic experience, this multi-crisis of health, economy, society, and institutions at the national and European level. I think we've all been shocked at the initial nationalist reflexes in European countries. That includes my own country, Germany, and that it took us all several weeks to recover from this. How much damage do you think was done by this? And if I may add on a second question, this proposed European Recovery Program fund, is that genuinely Hamiltonian moment? And if it isn't, since it doesn't provide for EU taxation or real European bonds, you know, is it enough to get us all together, you know, in solidarity out of this crisis?
Well, to your first question, the problem with this crisis in Europe is that health is a national competence. It's not the European competence. European competences on health are very limited. It's devolved to the member states. And actually within the member states, like in Spain, we even devolve it to the regions. So then a pandemic hits Europe and the reflex is, okay, we need to make sure that our healthcare system provides protection to our citizens. We very soon realized that under the pandemic, there was a threat to three essential ingredients of European integration. First was Schengen, freedom of movement within the EU. We started seeing borders close. That was big issue. Number two, we saw a threat to the internal market when countries started hoarding products and preventing them from circulating freely within the European market. And the third one we saw was a threat to the European Economic and Monetary Union. So it's when we realized that it wasn't just a pandemic, that it had huge ramifications to essential nerves of the European integration project, that we started to see also a response from the different European institutions, European Central Bank, Commission, and ultimately EU member states. The last piece that we still have to build, and let me tell you, Constance, that having seen the 2008 crisis, what we saw in Europe this time around is short of a small miracle. Because in the space of 3 months, we saw incredible measures being taken to respond to COVID. We still have to complete the arsenal of measures that Europe requires to face especially the economic recovery post-COVID. It's the recovery fund and the budget for the European Union for the next 7 years. These two pieces are being built at the moment. I would not call them a Hamiltonian moment. Not because I don't think they have some resemblances with what Hamilton did in the US. I prefer to use a Rousseau moment in Europe, because what we are trying... Rousseau, I've lived in Geneva, and you know that we in Geneva are very attached to Rousseau.
Yeah.
Why? Because what we are trying to do in Europe today is build a new social contract. That's what this recovery fund is about, is financing together the contract, the new contract for Europe, axed on sustainability, digitalization, and inclusiveness, making sure we leave no European citizen behind. That is what this plan looks like in this European Union moment version 2020.
All right, let me, I'd like to tease that out with you a little bit, but let me briefly address something that just dropped about an hour ago, the op-ed by the Swedish finance minister, one of the frugal four countries in Europe, among them Austria, the other ones being Austria, Netherlands, and Denmark, saying that, you know, this is all very good. We think that this European Recovery Fund is really, really great, but we are absolutely not having outright grants. It has to be loans. How do you think you overcome the clearly deeply felt resistance in these countries that somehow helping the southern nation states of Europe is with grants is giving them an undeserved present? I mean, the Dutch press has published, you know, newspaper covers saying as much. I mean, those were caricatures, but I think that's very much the thinking behind this. How do you persuade them that this is not the case?
Well, I would tell them it's the internal market, stupid, to borrow from Bill Clinton's famous sentence. It's not about charity. It's not about irresponsibility on the side of any member of the European Union. It's about ensuring the internal market continues to work. Now, how is it possible that the port of Rotterdam brings 6% of Dutch GDP? Because there is such thing called internal market. How is it possible that Germany sells half of the cars it produces in Europe? It's called internal market. So it's this internal market that is a question mark today. Either we have an exit from the crisis that allows us to leverage the internal market, and then we will exit fast, and we will exit with limited pain, or we will not. We will, you know, we will go on with a long recession, painful to everybody. Job losses to everybody, because the European Union internal market is the market of all Europeans. So don't do this out of charity, would be my answer to the Swedish minister. You don't have to do this for charity. Do it because this is what will grant you, your economy, the biggest return in the shortest time possible.
Got it. So the grant model being a sort of stimulus package that is in the self-interest, including the frugal four. Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, let me perhaps move back to the sort of vision behind all this, because Spain has been traditionally, interestingly, always a very pro-European integration culture, since Spain joined the EU very, very rapidly after Franco's death. And I think that at this point, you are perhaps ahead of the curve, definitely of the Italians, I think, certainly of the Northerners, the Hanseatic League, and the Eastern Europeans, who are sort of much more intergovernmental in their mood. And perhaps despite this historic turnaround in Germany, I think also ahead of the Germans. I think you're up there with Emmanuel Macron in France. So what ultimately is your vision for European integration? You just said, very interestingly, that you think what we need is a new European social contract where the sort of no citizen is left behind. But how do you translate that into integration at the institutional level? Is that what you want?
What we've always done in Spain is have a very honest conversation with our citizens. This is why we are pro-Europeans in terms of telling our citizens why and how the European Union brings benefits to us, brings improvements in our lives, improvements in our democracy, improvements in our well-being, improvements in our infrastructure. We've been honest about this conversation. We've not done what some other countries have done, which is if it works, it's all because the government is great. And if it doesn't work, it's because there is someone in Brussels that is imposing on us all this pain. So I think this is the basics for making sure citizens love Europe, is having an honest conversation about what Brussels Europe is about and how much of this is in the hands of member states and their own behavior and their own attitude towards the European integration. But today we're facing a very difficult moment, not just in Spain or in Europe, but around the world. For Europe, being able to exit this crisis solidly and better than the 2008 crisis will be a test of whether or not we learned the 2008 lesson. We in Spain have done things very differently this time around. We've not done what was done in 2008, deflate salaries, reduce purchasing power, get people unemployed, boost competitiveness by reducing basically the cost of labor. We've done it differently. We've preserved employment. We've made sure that people were protected, and we're seeing now that as soon as the economy starts picking up, these people come back into the labor market. So we've tried to reduce pain. The test of this crisis for Europe will be to show to European citizens that we've learned the lessons of 2008 and we can manage this crisis with better protection for them. But the second part has to do with Europe's role in the world. If we exit this crisis stronger, it will give us a possibility to shape tomorrow's world a little bit better than if we linger in a long and protracted crisis. The world is very geopolitically fractured today. If Europe wants to have a role in the world, it has to invest in becoming stronger today.
All right, Minister, you're a lawyer, as am I, and I'm noting you're sort of carefully not opting for one of the two options, deeper integration or more intergovernmentalism, which I respect. But let us perhaps move on to some of the questions that your last point raises, which is the Europe that we live in, or that you live in, and that I'm a citizen of, although I'm sitting on the other side of the Atlantic, still feel very emotionally attached to, is we're surrounded by the sort of most instable, volatile, and risky strategic geopolitical environment in your and my lifetimes, quite literally. Mm-hmm. At a time when Europe, has had to look at itself in the mirror in this crisis and seen some sort of quite nasty sides. It's also rallied, but the question is, how do we now deal with these external challenges going forward? And let me perhaps start with what's on our minds over here, which is the impending American election on November 3rd. Can I ask you to speculate on the two possible outcomes, which is a second Trump administration or a Biden administration, and say, what do we as Europeans have to offer a notoriously Eurosceptic American President Trump? And how do we, in case it's a President Biden who is faced with a set of domestic crises that his predecessor Obama, in the global financial crisis in 2009, pale beside in comparison, how do we get President Biden's attention? So how do we grapple with the Trump challenge, and how do we get Biden's attention?
Well, you will understand that I'm not going to take sides, mostly because this is probably the best way to continue to nurture the transatlantic relations. You see, the U.S. elections are the ones where we all watch, we all feel as if it was ours, but we don't get to vote. This is why we always have felt, at least in Spain, is that we have to invest in the long-term relationship between Spain and the United States. Administrations may change, governments in Spain may change, but what we have to do is build a relationship that has a long-term perspective and is based on a shared values, but also on shared objectives. And I think it is fair to say that in a way we've lost a bit of this soul of the transatlantic relation, and now I refer more to Europe, America. It used to be, during the Cold War, it was fighting authoritarian regimes, totalitarianism, spreading democracy around the world. Then it was the end of history, and then we moved and changed chapter. And in a way, we have lost. The core of what is our what is it that we want to do together? What is it that Europe and America want to do together? So we have to rescue this, and we've got to do with a sense that probably Europe has to be a little bit more strategically autonomous, that it has to be able to stand more on its two feet, and that America has to be a little bit more strategically engaged, that it has to be more interested in engaging in this case, Europe, also with the rest of the world, also multilaterally, but also with Europe in building a positive agenda for the transatlantic relations. I said on a past occasion, on a similar dialogue, that I think we need a new mission, and I see clearly what this mission could be. That's my view, in my view, could be around rehumanizing globalization, making it work, going back to the social contract, making sure we both work to make globalization work for every citizen in the transatlantic area.
Fair enough, Minister. But then, and I understand your desire not to take sides. I wasn't trying to get you to do that, but I see. I'm not a foreign minister, but let me talk to the experienced trade expert and say, if you're saying we need a new sort of humanized globalization, that's a very positive way of formulating something, a trend that also has some other aspects. And let me just name two. One is nation-state attempts at decoupling from globalization, and particularly from China, by protecting strategic assets, strategic businesses, etc. And the other aspect, which is a genuine reversal of the economic policy consensus, as opposed to the neoliberalism that was the ruling paradigm for many decades, is the return of nation-state industrial policy, even in my own country, Germany, where I thought I wouldn't see that again. Is that something that you think is a good way forward in order to help humanize globalization, by protecting citizens against it in this way?
Well, I think we can protect citizens without being protectionist. Actually, if we are protectionist, we're not going to be protecting citizens, because ultimately protectionism is a zero-sum game, economic protectionism, I mean. But we need to distinguish that from protecting citizens. Yes, we have to protect citizens. We've not been doing that. Look at inequalities rising in many of our societies, and look at the social pain that this has created. And look at how we are painfully discovering that also this inequality has a lot to do with deeply rooted discrimination, including racial discrimination. So yes, we have to protect people. But the question is, what's the best method to protect people? I think the best method is not to try and divide the world, is just try to find areas where we can cooperate, and we must cooperate. There is no question that if we are to decarbonize our economies and tackle climate change, we need every major emitter to be on that deal. And that means putting China into that deal, and having the US into that deal, and having India and the European Union into that deal. Now, there are also going to be areas where we see more of an adversarial relationship, more of a rivalry. And there, what we have to make sure is that there is a level playing field, that we're not going to have cheaters, irrespective of who is cheating. We don't want cheaters, especially if they are systemically important to our economy. So I guess we have to find a balance between finding spaces for cooperation and for working together. And we have multilateral institutions to do that. And we are going to also have to have more candid discussions, conversations, and probably action to ensure a better level playing field, including with partners with whom we don't think the rules of the game are being respected, whether these rules on the game are on the economy, they are on trade, on technology, on human rights, or the rest.
Right. Let me perhaps ask you about another aspect of this current new economic debate. We've seen an American, the Trump administration, weaponizing interdependence, as it's been called here, using economic tools, threats of trade war, sanctions, in order to come to grips with, or shall we say, how am I going to put this diplomatically? I don't think I can, to put the European Union in its place. And I think it's not entirely unlikely that even a democratic administration would also see the need to, shall we say, compete quite vigorously on issues like trade and data sovereignty with Europe in the transatlantic space. That strikes me as actually two of the most massive areas of friction, regardless of the nature of the next US administration. How should Europe position itself in this connection?
Well, I quite like competition, you know. I quite like competition. I think it spurs innovation, it spurs creativity, and that's good for our economies. Now, one thing is competition, another thing is disputes, differences, unfair competition, not respecting a level playing field. In a transatlantic relation, in a relation that has such a huge economic and investment content, both ways, by the way, because this is a relationship that is in the two directions. It's not as if Europe was not investing in America. It is investing in America. It's creating millions of jobs in America. And the same way, America is creating millions of jobs in the European Union. Well, when you have such a relationship, and frankly, it's a relationship that works, it's a relationship that is win-win. It's a relationship that is nurturing innovation, that is creating jobs, that is helping with improvements in people's lives. If there are differences, those differences have to be managed. And I prefer, I've lived through many challenges in the transatlantic relation and many trade disputes. But what I can tell you, Constance, is that it's much better if this be done in a manner that doesn't create further volatility. I think that in today's, especially today, a moment where we are going through huge economic and social uncertainties around the world with huge volatility, the last thing we need to do in the transatlantic relation is to add volatility. Our job should be to manage our differences, and we certainly have differences, to manage them in an intelligent manner, to manage them in a manner that helps solve the disputes, but also brings stability to a volatile world. That is what we should be doing, and that can be done. It's called dialogue.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think what I'm hearing is, you know, if Europe has the wherewithal and the confidence to endure a relationship with America that is both collaborative and competitive, and as it were, bring it on. We'll settle it. We'll settle it rationally. More power to you. I hope we can make that work. I would still like to have asked you about China, a huge issue, and the German presidency, but I'm aware that I've slightly overrun and at least want to bring in one audience question from Eric Fisher at the U.S. Naval War College Foundation. To what extent do you think that COVID-19 and its ripple effects will make European countries more inward or outward looking?
I think The jury is out. This is why I'm saying what we will see, this Roussonian moment that we are likely to see in the next few weeks with the approval of this recovery fund and budget. It's not just a recovery fund and a budget. It's a signal of whether or not Europe understands that it has a responsibility today towards its citizens, sure. but also to be a force for good in international affairs. And the jury is out. We certainly in Spain are playing, we are butting for the game that wants more engagement internationally, more international cooperation and better responses to our citizens. But we have to convince some of our partners. The work is ongoing. Like any time in European history, we will painfully build the European consensus. The only thing I can say is that once we've built it, hopefully we will this time, we will be stronger.
Right. I think that also answers the second question I got, which is on what are the opportunities coming out of this pandemic, which is the pandemic is the kind of systemic shock that comes along once in a lifetime. And that makes people willing to not just adapt, but to reform. But let me perhaps end by combining the two issues of China and the German presidency. As you know, the Germans take on the presidency at the beginning of July. The Leipzig summit now has been postponed. What's your biggest recommendation, your most important expectation of the German presidency in resolving this incredibly tense and increasingly aggressive relationship that we have with China? And it's not just a relationship that we have with our, you know, on the basis of our embassies back in Beijing, but that plays out in the European political theater every day on all sorts of different levels?
Three words: systemic, strategic, rivalry. Systemic, it speaks for areas where we have to find a positive agenda with China, because we need on certain areas, climate change, protecting biodiversity, ensuring the stability of the international financial system, we need to work together. That's systemic. Second, a strategic. We need in Europe to have a long-term view of our relationship with China, just like China takes a long-term view of its strategic relationship with Europe. And number three, rivalry. There are areas where Europe will have to fight to have a better level playing field with China. So it will have to be a combination of these three things. And if we are intelligent, and again, we think for the long term, we think now and we act now, but we have a view for our long-term relationship with China, it will work.
Tell me, how do we convince the countries that have already engaged deeply with China and Europe? I'm thinking of Hungary, I'm thinking of Greece, I'm thinking of Portugal and others. And I mean, the Chinese have been quite successful in persuading sectors of the German political and economic elites as well, that it is very, very important to be on their good side. How do we, but perhaps the Germans can afford to be choosy. The countries that have been hardest hit by the pandemic and were very hard hit by the Eurozone crisis, I think have a legitimate point in saying, you know what, Europe didn't treat us very well during the Eurozone crisis. We felt left alone at the beginning of the pandemic. What do you have to offer that is better than what the Chinese have to offer us? Why should we now side with Brussels rather than with Beijing?
But it's not about siding with Brussels or with Beijing. When you're a member of the European Union, you are the European Union. You are Europe. It's not that as if Europe was somebody else. You are Europe. You make Europe. You decide how Europe behaves and you decide how Europe engages with the rest of the world, including with China. So back to systemic strategic rivalry. There has to be a positive agenda. When you've got a big player that represents a huge part of the international economy, a huge part of international trade, a huge part of world emissions, a huge part of your treasury bills, you have to engage. You need to be clear about the terms of the engagement, but you have to have a positive agenda. Now, you also have to have a clear sense of where you are a competitor and what are the terms of that competition, and making sure that the terms are fair, that there is no cheating and that there is no non-level playing field that works only for the benefit of one side.
Fair enough. Minister, I think that was a fantastic final statement. I'm happy to see a Spanish foreign minister be so engaged and so punchy. That's in the best Spanish tradition of post-Franco-Europeanism. And it's good to see. It's been a huge pleasure having you as our final speaker in this conversation for our biannual Brookings Bosch Transatlantic Initiative event. And I can only say I hope that we will all soon be in a position to continue this conversation in person, either in Madrid or on a stage at Brookings. I think that would be absolutely wonderful. I don't really want to return in every way to a pre-pandemic world, because I think that this has all been very instructive. But the one thing I really want to have back is sitting in a room with people and having a real conversation over, you know, maybe a cortado in the Spanish way. And I hope that will be soon. I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you for doing us the honor of participating. And with that, I'm going to close this conference and say thank you to all our distinguished guests, to the Bosch Foundation, a longstanding partner of Brookings of ours. I was a Bosch senior fellow, the first one for 5 years, and it changed my life. And I would also like to thank my colleagues who've been on this call all morning, I've been listening to with enormous interest, as always. And finally, our audience for participating, staying with us, and sending us great questions. So thank you very much, Minister. Stay well.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much, Constance, and see you in Madrid.
Muy bien. Ha sido un placer, Doña Arancha.
Gracias.
Adiós.
Gracias. Adiós.